It's August 30th, 2021, and I am David Knight with Project JFK CSI Dallas. This is Project JFK CSI Dallas presents the Journey Spotlight Series with our special guest tonight. It's going to be David Denton, and he is going to be doing his presentation here just in a couple seconds. I would like to remind everybody that the chat feature is on, so if you would like to share information, please do so. There's going to be four parts tonight to David's presentation, and in between those four parts, we're going to stop for a Q&A. So during those breaks, I ask that any questions that you may have, please limit them to what was presented just before the Q&A break. And if you have questions that maybe you think of later on, please go ahead and ask those at the end of tonight. And for anyone that maybe their microphones don't work, you can always submit your questions in the chat log, and I'll be more than happy to read those to Mr. Denton, and then he can give an answer to that. So for those of you that joined us in the past, you will realize that our Journey Meeting Spotlight Series is a little bit different. It's not kind of a free-for-all like our normal Saturday meetings are. This is more of a refined kind of like a conference presentation to the extreme, more than just a normal 50-minute presentation. Also, the replay will be posted by tomorrow. So if those of you that may need to leave early, we totally understand that. Just remember that if you leave early, then, of course, if you have questions, you won't be able to get those answered here in the meeting. But that will be up on our YouTube channel and also on projectjfk.com. And for those of you that like what we're doing and continue want to have us continue doing what we're doing, if you would like to make a donation, you're more than welcome to at projectjfk.com's homepage. You can click the donate button and make a donation if you choose. With that, I am going to give a introduction here, and then we will start off. David Denton has served as a social science professor at Olney Central College since 1990. In 2001, he began teaching a course on political assassinations of the 1960s, which explores the deaths of President John F. Kennedy, Robert F. Kennedy, and Martin Luther King Jr. Denton became interested in the JFK assassination in the late 1980s, and for two decades has attended historical symposiums on the subject in Dallas, Texas. He has interviewed several people associated with the case and has researched hundreds of documents related to both Kennedy and suspected assassin Lee Harvey Oswald. In 2013, he helped organize a two-day event at OCC marking the 50th anniversary of Kennedy's death. The conference brought together nationally known academics, scholars, and authors to lend their perspectives on the events leading up to and following the assassination. In 2014, Denton organized and participated in a national conference in Washington, D.C., focusing on the Warren Commission report. Mr. Denton has authored several articles based on his extensive research. A collection, Essays on the Assassination of President John F. Kennedy, was published by Midnight Rider News and is available at www.lulu.com and jfkhistorical.com. David has given numerous presentations on the JFK assassination across Illinois and Indiana at both public libraries and forums. He participated in the Illinois Humanities Council Speakers Bureau from 1995 to 2002. Giving presentations on Oswald, the JFK assassination, and the Vietnam War. In recent years, David directed an oral history project exploring the Vietnam War 25 years later. The work, funded through the Illinois Humanities Council, features interviews with 125 veterans from across Illinois and across the nation. The resulting 600-page document was distributed to local libraries. Denton also produced the video documentary Victory on the Home Front, Remembrances of Lawrence and Richland Counties During World War II. The IHC-funded project includes interviews with Lawrence and Richland County residents, detailing the activities, sacrifices, and patriotism that they experienced while living on the home front. Denton holds both a bachelor's and master's degree from Eastern Illinois University. He was the 1999 recipient of the OCC Alumnus Award. Tonight's presentation is entitled Coup d'etats in America, What Do the JFK Files Tell Us? And with that, I'm going to turn it over to David Denton and let him give us his presentation. So David, go ahead and take it away. David, your microphone's on mute.
Now, how's that?
That's better. Go ahead.
Okay. Now, can you hear me now, Dave?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay. Can I go ahead and bring my presentation up?
Yeah,
okay.
Absolutely.
Okay. So, is that good on your end?
No, go ahead and click share screen, and then you're going to pick the window that your PowerPoint presentation is on.
All right. Okay. So, all right. I got to get rid of this. Let's see. Minimize that. Okay, we'll get there. Let's see. That's it. Still struggling here, Dave.
All right, we'll take the time.
Okay, now I have share screen here.
Okay, yeah, and then you'll click your PowerPoint window.
Okay.
And make sure you turn your video back on.
All right. And where's that at?
That should be where it has like a little video icon along the panel, either at the top or at the bottom.
Okay, I see it now. Okay, I'm still, this one thing, I gotta hit share right here. Start my video.
Yep.
We're gonna get there, I hope. Now, how about now?
Okay, the screen that you have up is not your PowerPoint.
Okay. Now it is?
Yeah, now go ahead and enlarge that window. There you go. And then you can move that to slideshow.
All right.
And then from beginning.
Oh, yeah. All right. From current slide, possibly?
Yeah, that'll work.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, finally. Okay. Good.
There we go.
Apologize for all the histrionics there, but appreciate to get on board. Okay. Well, thanks for having me, David. And thanks for your patience, everybody. I was scheduled for last week. I'm one of my many hats. I'm also a football coach, and we had an issue with heat and had to have a late practice last week and game week. Unfortunately, it didn't help. We lost. Maybe I should have just had the presentation anyway. But I'm glad to be here tonight and glad to share this with you. The basis of my presentation tonight will be a extensive article I've wrote on a number of things, many of them associated with the documents. I've obviously been spending time looking at the documents from the National Archives. They've been declassified over the last 3 years. We've downloaded those at Olney Central College, about 4,000 of them. Of course, that's not a complete, as most of you know, and some of you probably know more about this than I, but it was a limited release of documents, yet there's still some things that were very informative. Some stuff still redacted. I'm going to be talking about that tonight. And most of you are aware of the fact that former President Trump said the remainder of documents would be released in October of 2021. That still is an issue that's up in the air, of course, because Trump gave an executive order, but executive orders only last as long as you are president of the United States. So we'll see what happens, whether we ever get a complete look at everything that was in the National Archives. Who knows? We'd certainly like to see it. There's some things that are eye-opening that we've seen already. And I want to touch on some of these things and also kind of give a narrative to them you know, in some respects. But I also want to say this. I don't want to be a claim to be the, you know, world's expert on many of these things. You know, some of them, there's some great researchers out there that have probably done more things on some of these than I. I try to stay in my lane. I try to, if I find something I think is significant, that's worth talking about, that connects to other things, then I try to run with it. The reason why I put a title of two-day Taz in America, because I chose to do something with this article, and I'm going to do something tonight, and it may be politically charged. I understand that, but and I'll talk more about this later. But I've talked with a couple trusted guys that I know in the research field. One, Mal Hyman, from professor from South Carolina. I'll talk more about my conversation with him about that. And also Ed Tatro about, you know, what happened on January 6th? Was it a two-day talk? Does it compare to what happened in Dallas? What were the parallels? Where are they different? And, you know, depending on your political persuasion, you might have an entirely different opinion about whatever did or did not happen in January 6th. But I want to look at these things because, you know, we define what is a coup d'etat. What does it mean to be? What happens when folks attempt to conduct some type of overthrow, overturning of election through violent overthrow, through assassination, through whatever means? It hasn't happened that often in America. Most of us, and obviously in the field that we are in, the folks that are here, believe that definitely there was a coup d'etat in America in 1963. And whether that, how that rings true in January, well, that's one of the things I want to touch on, along with a lot of the new documents. So that's a little bit of my intro. Some of you might have seen some of the things I've talked about before. If you've seen my presentations before, what I try to do is there is sometimes an overlap with what I do, and I apologize if you've seen some of the things that I've talked about before, but I'm always trying to kind of add to it a little bit, or more context to it, or make a few more connections and try to build those things from there with some of the documents we're about to look at. So this is really a kind of a broad-based thing I try to do, both with my article and my presentation. I'm trying to cover some ground on documents and also some narrative, some historical narrative as well. So if that hopefully will get you to understand what I'm trying to accomplish here. Okay, well, let's go on. My first slide here talks about, and I think this is always something that all of us, because I know many of you are engaged in some of the same things I've done dealing with the Kennedy assassination. We probably get, all of us get questions all the time. We pay attention to what's in the media about the JFK assassination 58 years later, and it still comes up. It may come up in ways that we don't like, but it still comes up. And sometimes those ways are frustrating for us, and it's frustrating for me. I mean, and I see a narrative in the past couple of years with what's gone on, particularly obviously with the pandemic, quote unquote conspiracy theories that are out there from different things. And sometimes we see what I would call the media establishment, whatever, how you want to characterize those folks that find themselves in the media, that the JFK assassination has some relevancy to the fact that it maybe connects to as being a forerunner to today's paranoia out there, whether it be QAnon believers, stolen elections, anti-vaxxers. I mean, and again, those are all things that are all, I understand, politically charged. But I think that's not a fair narrative. I know most of you would agree the same thing. Because many of those things that we just mentioned are baseless in some cases, or in most cases. I mean, the QAnon stuff, who knows how far out that might go. And it's a false narrative. And as I say, all conspiracies are not alike. Basically, because when we look at the JFK assassination, there are facts of conspiracy, and we can – you know, we can go and have, and I know many of you that are here tonight have done that as well as I have to try. I in my article, I suggest it's become particularly tiresome to have to argue the same facts over and over again that make it so clear that there was a conspiracy in Dallas without or beyond a doubt. I mean, I'll recount a story because, you know, I'm obviously good friends with Ed Tatrol, and I think most of you are aware. Ed is a researcher, you know, and I was in the process of doing this article that I'm using tonight as the basis for my presentation. And I had several editors looking at it, and including Ed. And Ed was kind of harsh on me simply because, you know, he felt like I was not strong enough in repudiating the idea whatsoever that there was, without a doubt, a conspiracy in Dallas, that the facts are beyond debate. And that's true. I mean, and it's hard, and I'm not going to go over all those facts. I mean, I'm sure all of you are aware of them. But because of that, you know, I think instead of having to argue those facts, and I'm not saying it's, you know, I don't want to. I teach a political assassinations class, and I had a great group, by the way, this year. I hope to, with some of the presentations possibly this November, hopefully we have in Dallas, I hope to engage those folks. And it's always fun to take a group of college students and walk them through this basic series of evidence and show just how ridiculous the idea that anyone is still arguing that there wasn't a conspiracy, that it was Oswald alone, that it's so clear if you take the time to look at those facts. So with that, I think the real relevancy in 2021 about the JFK assassination, I think it, from a historical standpoint, is the fact that, you know, here we are 58 years later, that any ultimate truth enabling a pursuit of justice regarding JFK assassination, there's a clear line that can be drawn between 11-22-63 and today's public distrust of what they're told. To me, that's the real connection with the JFK assassination of today, I think, is that you can almost draw a line between the beginnings of public distrust in what our government and our institutions have been telling the American people. There's a clear variance there between the institutional narrative of what happened in Dallas and the majority of Americans that believe the opposite, despite being bombarded with program after program and you know, media distortions and marginalizing those who suggest conspiracy. Yet still, here we are, that the public has a distrust with what they're told. That's part of the problems we run into today with some of the issues that I just mentioned earlier, you know, a general public distrust in our institutions has caused a great deal of difficulty. To me, that's one of the major lessons of Dallas, and I just wanted to strongly make that point. So let's keep going. So let's get into some documents, if we will, and some things that I have uncovered that I think are significant. And I want to start with this because, again, this is pretty relevant to in recent news. I think you probably, those of you who have researched this, probably recognize the fact that I refer to him as CIA chief and leftover Cold Warrior R. James Woolsey, who released a book earlier this year entitled Operation Dragon, Inside the Kremlin's Secret War on America. And, again, I can kind of recall some folks coming up to me, what do you think about that? I mean, could the Russians been involved with the JFK assassination? And of course, I think the easy answer is it's complete disinformation. I mean, the idea that Khrushchev and the Russians might have, conducted an assassination attempt against JFK as some revenge situation, it just doesn't hold up. It has no rational basis. And I think this is a complete falsehood circulated by somebody in the CIA immediately after the event as well, and has no rational basis. When you take a look at the history and the things associated between particularly Kennedy and Khrushchev and what was going on, I mean, we're all well aware, I think, of the American University speech in June of 63, where Kennedy really, in essence, is reaching out with a sort of rapprochement, if I say that correctly, and the Soviet reaction at that point in time. Historically speaking, that American University speech given by JFK, "We are all mortal" speech, was the first speech printed verbatim without redactions in the Soviet controlled media. It got their attention. It got Khrushchev's attention. They could begin to see maybe as JFK as a rational partner and working towards some sort of peace, some way out of a potential World War III and Cold War situation. And it just doesn't make any sense that, you know, why would this, and obviously the nuclear test ban treaty that came in September, why would the Soviets risk World War III with an assassination attempt? It doesn't pass the rational test. And I bring this up because I think there was a significant document that we came across in the National Archives that kind of validates that. I want to show that to you. Of course, here's the New York Post article associated with Woolsey's book. There we go. But here's a very important document, I think, that would kind of look at this thing. Dated 1967, Shamrock, who apparently is some sort of inside source inside the KGB that the CIA had, is reporting back how the Russians, their viewpoints about what happened in Dallas. Now, we've already seen some things. I mean, this national press came out. I think there were other documents came out that early on that the KGB and the Russians believed behind the scenes with documents that the ultra-right wing and possibly Lyndon Johnson may have been involved. You might remember those headlines. But here's something that goes a little further with this. Shamrock reports that the Soviets had the KGB and made an extensive study of the assassination. And the result of this study, the KGB concluded that President Kennedy was killed by representatives of a group of monopolists characterized as the military-industrial complex in the United States. Interesting, the monopolists, the military-industrial complex, with their conclusions. The KGB felt that President Kennedy had tried to limit the activities of the group of monopolists, and therefore they planned the assassination. Now, that's, you know, that again, something that we've already looked at maybe a little bit before, but further down, I just find this stuff fascinating here at the bottom of this document. Shamrock, as this inside source, reported that Soviets felt that President Kennedy's death was a great loss, not only for the United States and the Soviet Union, but for the whole world. According to Shamrock, the Soviets felt that they could trust Kennedy, they could deal with him on a cooperative basis, and further stated the Soviets mourned Kennedy's death, a situation with Shamrock considered very unique in as much they were mourning a leader of another country. Now, I asked you, I mean, I would ask our James Woolsey, you know, this, why would the Russians, you know, someone that they held apparently with such high regard, according to this document, they mourned his death, how they would be associated in that assassination. I think this document just further confirms, I think, the ridiculousness of that idea and the disinformation that might be, at least in my opinion. So, okay, well, let's go on. Well, I've talked about this is some that, you know, those of you who have had me before, there's some of this might be a review, but again, I kind of want to lay the groundwork for this a little bit. I mean, in terms of the CIA folks that we want to look at, and I think I want to focus on three: Harvey, E. Howard Hunt, and David Morales, because we've had a chance to look at the documents, the personnel files of all three. I've talked about Harvey a little bit before, so again, I apologize if you heard some of this stuff, but it kind of leads on. But let's start with Harvey here. You know, Harvey's oftentimes been described as a real-life James Bond. Although he certainly, as I think I've said before, he looks more like Jackie Gleason than James Bond, but he is, you know, he fits that profile. He fits the perfect profile as someone in the Central Intelligence Agency capable of participating in and carrying out an assassination plot. He was described in the files as being involved in highly sensitive, extremely political operations. He comes across as dangerous and rogue. even on his files, though Harvey is, I think, is regarded in high regard by the CIA, they also recognize he could, in essence, get out in front of his skis, do things beyond, as it says, his position stronger than his superior officers, very tenacious and aggressive in his point of view. He had disposal of his own officers loyal to him. He described as Harvey men. I mean, these are things, if you're looking for someone or a group to associate in an extreme or radical event, this fits the profile, I believe. And again, a commendation in 1956 that I found in his files talks about extremely sensitive details concerning it are such that considerations preclude the filing of accommodation in Mr. Harvey's folder at this time. So as early as 1956, apparently William Harvey was doing some stuff the CIA felt like we don't even want to put in the files. And so he was capable of extreme things. I think that's something that's going to be a theme throughout when we talk here. So let's move on. Harvey dealt with Johnny Roselli, of course, from the mob, the liaison between the CIA and the mob. I mean, the CIA at one point, we found documents that in their euphemistic terms talked about engaging in gangster type actions. In other words, they're willing to go hire mob people to do their dirty work. And of course, Robert Mayhew was one of the go-betweens making connections. This is all stuff maybe you already know. But I thought it was very interesting that Harvey, one of the documents I found that really just covered Roselli's entire relationship with the CIA. But when it gets to the point in time when in May of 62, when William Harvey takes over as case officer of John Roselli, the CIA says, we don't know what was going on operationally from that point on. In other words, the CIA is either admitting they don't want to talk about Roselli and his relationship with Harvey, or they really don't know what they were up to. So keep that in mind. Of course, all sorts of things about Roselli, where he was at the time of the assassination, his whole role. I mean, that's a whole story in and of itself. I really don't have time to get into it. Many of you probably already know about it. Okay. In November of 62, Harvey writes a long report of the situation in Cuba. There's a sense of resignation and frustration, and openly criticizing the Kennedy administration after the failure of the Bay of Pigs and Cuban Missile Crisis. You know, that's a prime example where Harvey really got out ahead of himself, because Harvey, of course, didn't wait for a supposed invasion of Cuba at the height of the Cuban Missile Crisis. He sent his teams in to Cuba to wreak havoc and conduct limited war. And I think that's a big reason why even folks in the CIA were ticked off at Harvey and had him exiled to Rome. In fact, here's a document. I don't know how well you can read that. Such things as, I know even Lansdale was particularly upset with Harvey's actions in Cuba. Talked about he'd broken his lance and had to be replaced. He earned another black mark for not being fully under control. So there you go. You get some things that about Harvey. And, you know, this point in time where he's exiled in Europe, you know, I really feel like, and I've talked about this, I really feel like that puts him in a perfect position to potentially recruit foreign assassins, do things, plot overseas. We can only speculate. And we know that Harvey, you know, the mysterious QJ Wynn, I've talked about this before, but, you know, we found a document that where Harvey was interviewed by the House Select Committee in 1976. I believe that's after he'd already left the agency. And they really pressed him on his association with QJ Wynn. Now, I'm sure you're familiar. There have been discussions who that's the code name, who QJ Wynn was, whether he was in the United States, whether he's a potential assassin or not. The House Select investigators pressed him on, in particular, the assassination of the African leader Lumumba and the potential involvement of QJ Wynn. And, of course, Harvey pushed that all away. And they even called Harvey out about, you know, QJ Wynn was in the United States at one point. And Harvey denied that. And then the House Select Committee people come, or the investigators, says, look, we've got a plane ticket that you took care of for QJ Wynn flying from Miami to Chicago. So basically, he was caught almost red-handed there denying the fact that QJ Wynn was in the United States. Then he tried to claim it was – he actually tried to claim it was Johnny Roselli, which is kind of ridiculous. But this – I think this is important as we get to this. When one point in the interview is very important with the House Select had with Harvey, I think, where they really press him about the idea of what, you know, relationships, connections, recruiting assassins. And basically Harvey, I always refer to it as these, his few good men moment, where he just kind of blurts this thing out, where he brashly states the one sure way to do it, assassinate someone, was to simply appoint a single senior officer to do everything, to run the operation, to kill the person, bury the body, and tell no one. It's like a bold statement. It's hard to say whether Harvey was being deceptive or, you know, there are deeper implications in what he was saying there about what it takes, who might be behind an assassination. And I want, and some of you have heard this before, and I want to bring, there's a specific reason why I wanted to bring this quote up again, whether you've heard it before, it kind of connects to something what I want to get to later. So that's Harvey. That's some of the things we found in the documents about him. Let's go on, if we can, to, let's see, guys, that one, yeah, I skipped over. Let's talk about E. Howard Hunt a little bit. Now, with Hunt, you know, when you try to analyze how the agency's attitude towards these guys were by looking at their personnel files, I think it's definitely more mixed opinion about Hunt and E. Howard Hunt and his whole actions. I think they saw value in E. Howard Hunt, but they also kind of saw where he could possibly be a loose cannon. And some of those things come up with some of the documents that we uncovered. By the way, we did a FOIA request on Hunt, about a year and a half ago, I think, and a year later, we did get 400 pages of documents that CIA shipped us to Albany Central College about E. Howard Hunt, and we dutifully went through all of them. I'm not saying I think there's still stuff that they may have redacted. Many of the things were already out, but there were some interesting tidbits in all those documents that we looked at with Hunt. One of the things, he did receive some black marks as an operator for the CIA over a number of security issues. He leaked classified information in Uruguay. He, in 1969, of course, by then he was kind of in and out of the agency as a contract guy. It's kind of vague about who he's working for all the way leading up to, of course, the whole Watergate affair and all that. But he was reprimanded in 1969 for intentionally leaving a safe open. You know, I just wonder, was that just careless on his part, or was he leaving something open for somebody can get? Of course, think about it. Watergate, a few years later, what did that involve? Breaking open a safe. So I don't know if that just kind of came to mind to me, but whether that has significance, I don't know. So the agency was concerned about the fact that the novels that, of course, Hunt fancied himself a writer and penned many novels, but many of those novels were like just not so subtle discussions about things that maybe his experiences in the CIA. He was on more than one occasion called in for, you know, revealing too much in some of the books that he was wanting to write and they wanted to censor him. At one point, Hunt even asked if he was going to be audio taped, which is ironic. You know, again, you know, does that indicate paranoia on Hunt's part with the agency by that time? Or, you know, was it smart for him to do that? I don't know, but it's interesting that maybe that lack of trust that might have been there by the late 1960s. Of course, like Harvey, Hunt was ultimately if you want to call it, exiled to the CIA base in Madrid in 1964 after he was involved in some surveillance with, he was trailing around Barry Goldwater during the 64 presidential campaign for God knows what reason. So Hunt was a guy that was just kind of all over the place, you know, in what he did. And sometimes he stepped on the wrong toes, I think, in the agency, I believe. So let's talk about Dave Morales, because I like to put all these, all three of these guys in perspective, because they, you know, they're kind of a, you know, almost the three musketeers when we start talking about the JFK assassination and their potential involvement or what they did or what they did not do. There's no doubt about it. Dave Morales, and I think Larry Rivera sent me some documents. I want to give him credit for that. He's found quite a bit on Morales, and he's spoken about this and other things. But Morales, no doubt, had a stellar reputation with the agency. He was kind of a do-it-all guy. I mean, a 61 document described him as a one-man gang. And I'm going to come back to that in a minute. I want to connect that with something I mentioned earlier. And his work was of the highest order, quantitatively and qualitatively. He was further described for his versatility while operating out of the JM Wave Station, excelling in all sorts of counterintelligence, sabotage, political action, propaganda. And then it mentions in the document, and a great number of miscellaneous activities that defy classification. Here we go again. The CIA is apparently suggesting here, even there in their classified documents, that Morales is up to some stuff that they don't want to even want to talk about. So that's why I say we can only speculate what that means. So let's go back to that one-man gang thing for a minute, though, because remember earlier, and I went through the Harvey stuff again, and I just sometimes I try to make connections, and I just wonder when Harvey made that statement to the House Select Committee, he said, takes one man to do it all. Was he talking about Dave Morales? I mean, obviously Morales was, we know that, made some subtle submissions of its potential involvement. Others have pointed the finger at him in terms of the JFK assassination. And so those are the kind of things I try to look for in terms of narrative and the documents. I mean, you know, we, most of us look at documents. We don't claim to find smoking guns or here's who did it, that sort of thing. But if you dig down into these and do some, you know, some, apply some imagination to what we're looking at, maybe we can see more about what some of these things say. So would this be a good time of day to kind of take a stop here and stop for questions? I'm not, what do you think, Dave? Is that a good time now or should I go on?
Yeah, I think we could stop and take some questions and then we can continue.
Okay.
All right, let's open up the questions and answers section here. Does anybody have any questions from what David has said so far in his part one of his presentation? I know that there was one question that was asked. Do you have the RIF numbers to the documents that you showed? Do you happen to have those?
I can get them, and I will try. I mean, sometimes they are... You know, it's a mixed bag. When we download some of these documents, sometimes they show those numbers on the actual document, and sometimes they're in the files, of course. I mean, they're there somewhere. Yes, I mean, we can. I mean, for those of you that haven't spent a lot of time looking at the National Archives, for one thing, if you know, you can go and I mean, we downloaded on an Excel spreadsheet the entire JFK files, you know, whatever it is, 3,500 documents. Now, sifting through them is another story. It has a search engine, but it's a finicky one. I mean, that'd be the best way to describe it. Sometimes things come up, sometimes they don't. I mean, I'll be honest with you, with some of the stuff we've seen and looked at, more oftentimes it's almost like we've stumbled on the stuff or we've looked for one thing and here's something else. I mean, like I'll give an example. I mean, I recall, in fact, it was actually one of my worst people that did this. I'm not, I'm not going to talk about a document associated with Vietnam tonight, but it was a pretty incredible document that went into a long explanation of the CIA's connection or lack thereof to the Diem assassination obviously in Vietnam. And all my work study person did was put in, he just typed in Vietnam. So, and it came up. It's like sometimes it's simple, it's right in front of you, and then these things come up. But I'm just telling you, if you go in, you got to be persistent when you look at these things. And, there are numbers available. And I would encourage anybody, if you want to email me or by any access you might want to have, I'll track those down. I'll send you those numbers of any of those that you might want to look at further.
Okay, that sounds great. Does anybody have any questions for David? You can either put him in the chat feature or you can come right on and ask him yourself.
Hey, David, this is Casey Quinlan. How do you, over all of your research, especially on David Morales, the CIA gives a pretty good background on who he's supposed to be, and then over the years we've seen his own explanation of who he is and some of the people around him. Out of the JM Wave Station, we've seen several books that have said that, you know, he might be a one man show altogether. How do you feel about him being one of the assassins on the murder of JFK?
I can see him. You know, everybody's got a speculation. I don't see him being a guy actually pulling the trigger, but I can certainly see him being one of the central planners of this, and maybe along with Harvey, in terms of being, at least on a mechanical level, being utilized at some level to bring in assassins, to put people in place. And we're going to talk, you and I, we've talked a lot about potential military connections, and we're going there next, you know, or we're getting there on the military side of it. But let's point out, and you know, that in some of the documents that we're going to look at later this evening, they're all about the CIA and the military in many cases in collaboration with each other. It's almost like we're going to talk about some people coming up here where they even talk about, they don't even know which one they were working for. They were like for both. So I hate to be exclusive about saying this person or that person is the guy, you know, because I think that at the end of the day, this was a collaborative effort. But I have to believe that Morales would not have been left out of this operation. He seems to be in the middle of everything. He was in the middle of the whole Bay of Pigs affair. And we'll talk about that later where, you know, maybe everybody else that went into, as I have up here by design, might have been the C team as I'm about to talk about, that maybe designed to fail. But Morales was there too, the Bay of Pigs. And I just wonder if he's kind of like the controlling factor, the overseer in that operation as well. But that's just speculation, Casey. By the way, I'm going to quote you on something later, so be ready, okay?
All right.
Any other questions?
All right. Well, I don't think that anybody has any questions. You know, they're not speaking up for it. So I know it's kind of the start into the presentation. So let's go ahead and move on with the next section there, David.
Okay, good. Well, this is I kind of was discussing that earlier that this whole thing about the Bay of Pigs. And I think I found what I feel is a really important document about that that I want to lead into it, and also talk about Mr. Alan Dulles in association with that and some other things as well. So, you know, as my slides suggest up here, JFK researchers have long speculated the Bay of Pigs operation by the CIA was set up to fail in order to maneuver JFK into a full-fledged invasion into communist Cuba, and there are good reasons to believe that. I think a great source for reading about that, and there are plenty of sources, but David Talbot's book, about Alan Dulles, the devil on the chessboard, I mistitled that, but it talks about Dulles and his strange behavior during that whole Bay of Pigs operation while he was so disengaged in what should have been a very important operation. I think he was giving a speech down in Puerto Rico, and when the CIA, other people in the CIA were freaking out when the operation with the Bay of Pigs seemed to be falling apart, Dulles seemed to be not too concerned about it. Others have suggested that one of the top guys in the CIA would later suggest that they really didn't send in the B team into the Bay of Pigs operation. It's more like the C-minus team, the top people that should have been involved in that project were not there. I think the exception to that is that Morales. Morales was involved, I kind of wonder about that. But they were just kind of pulled together, a kind of disparate group that maybe wasn't up to the task to even pull off the whole assignment, which would, again, maybe give an indication that did the CIA really want this thing to fall apart, to force Kennedy into, backing him into a corner where he had to invade Cuba. And I think this is a document that I want to show next that maybe reinforces that idea. This is shortly after the whole Bay of Pigs affair. And it's actually a reporter from the New York Journal. And I researched him. I really couldn't find a whole lot on him other than the fact I think he did ultimately move on from the New York Journal is no longer in existence. As you search that, you'll find that out. He moved on, I believe, to the New York Times. But what I think Brigham was, although it does not say that in the document, I think he was Mockingbird. I mean, the whole operation of, that the ongoing situation where the CIA had reporters' assets, they referred to media assets that reported to them, that reported friendly stories for the CIA and so on and so on. And this is the reason why I believe that, but because Brigham actually goes to a CIA station and reports dutifully that he did a lot of interviews with the Cuban exiles that were associated with the Bay of Pigs operation afterwards and personal sources. And he came to the conclusion that the recent invasion was badly handled from every aspect by the CIA, in the opinion of many of the Cuban exiles. Now, we always had this narrative that the Cuban exiles blame Kennedy, and I'm sure that there's truth in that. But it's interesting. Here we go. A lot of those guys on the ground that were conducting that operation were also incensed with the CIA itself and how it was handled. He said that even a segment of the Cuban exiles are of the opinion, and this is very important, that the recent Cuban invasion was doomed to failure by design on the part of the CIA and holding the CIA responsible. I mean, that's a damning piece of evidence or a document that prevailing attitude that the CIA wanted this thing to fail. And that would be further confirmation, I think, that, they really were trying to paint JFK into a corner to come in and send in the military, that was the only way to really achieve their objectives, that they had no intentions of this thing actually effectively working. Okay? So I think this is an important document, so I want to share that with you. Okay, let's go on. And more about Dulles, okay, since we got on that subject. Of course, I've also came across a document I think that's significant in that it kind of, we kind of want to look at this narrative that how much Alan Dulles was involved in terms of the cover-up and of the assassination afterwards. Of course, we all know Harry Truman wrote an op, and the former president at that time, Harry Truman, like a month after the assassination, writes an op-ed article, you know, just blasting the CIA as far as being out of control. I've never had any thought that when I set up the CIA that it would be injected into peacetime cloak and dagger operations. It didn't take too much reading into that at all, but the timing of that Truman had suspicions of the CIA and the assassination of JFK. I mean, he didn't come out and say that, but the timing of it is undeniable. So we know Dulles, you know, he's doing damage control right away. He writes, first of all, writes a letter to Truman asking to back off from his position. He pays a personal visit, and Truman just said, "No, I'm not backing down." When all that failed, he even tried through some secondhand sources to suggest that Truman, by that time, 80 years old, was senile. Well, there, it's very clear that Truman went right on. There was nothing about senility there. There were other assertions after that Truman continued to make about the CIA being a rogue operation. But it also, to me, suggests that Dulles is front and center in terms of the cover-up of the JFK assassination. Well, we know that, you know, he was obviously appointed to the Warren Commission by LBJ, and he was very much in control of everything in terms of the evidence from that end of it as well. But another document kind of really illuminates that, too, that we came across that I think is significant. I want to show that to you. I don't have that actual document, but I'm just going to characterize it because when we tried to download it into the PowerPoint, it just wasn't legible. So I'm just going to go ahead and explain what the document did say to you. And then all these documents, by the way, like, you always have to wonder. If you read into this, you have to wonder. They seem to be not necessarily totally connected to the JFK assassination, or they might say be on the surface significant. But then again, there's a reason. Why were they segregated in the JFK files? Why are they been classified? Why was a report given by a reporter about the Bay of Pigs classified for so long? Why was this document I'm about to talk about classified for so long? Or at least for a period of time. So what is this particular document I'm talking about? Well, it's months after the assassination. It's a secret document dated April 30th, 64. And it was sent to, by Deputy Director of Plans, Richard Helms, to then, I want to emphasize, private citizen, Alan Dulles. Okay? Dulles had no official relationship with the CIA. And the document basically is alerting Dulles to the fact that a book was being written by Thomas Buchanan. I think some of you might be familiar with it. I think my friend Pete Hymans, I don't know if he's here tonight, but Pete said, "Hey, I read that book right away when it came out." I have not read it. I mean, it was one of the first books of it coming out that suggested conspiracy. But at that time, it was really evident that the CIA was making a concerted effort to shut everything down in terms of any even suggestion of conspiracy. They were going after anybody that even attempted to write books or anything or making. We know that. We know. I mentioned down there Joachim Joosten and Mark Lane were other early conspiracy authors that were attacked, like Buchanan, and smeared by the CIA and the FBI. Buchanan was a avowed left winger, you know, and of course they went after him as being a communist. But the point of the matter, I think, here is this. You know, Helms is taking the time to contact Dulles and say, "Hey, this book is about to come out, and I think out of England, and you need to be alerted to the fact so we can turn on the whole you know, cover-up machine to shut this thing down before it even gets started. It's an indication to me that Dulles is the key person outside the agency, but nonetheless the key person in handling the cover-up of the assassination. And by the way, that document also mentions, and you get a lot of code names, code words in the documents, and in that document, GP4 comes up, and GP4 was the designation by the CIA for Lee Harvey Oswald. And the document actually talks about, I think, segregating somehow this information about Buchanan with the maybe with things about Oswald. But it is interesting that terminology comes up, that Oswald's even mentioned in this. So interesting document. I think it tells us a little bit about who was really in behind some of the cover-up and how it was being orchestrated early on after the JFK assassination. Okay? All right. So, again, the people I'm going to talk about next I found some interesting things about a couple of Cuban exiles. And again, I question why are they, you know, there must be a reason these guys are segregated into the JFK files. I think we have to understand that they're not, make no mistake about it, these two gentlemen, I'm not suggesting were necessarily involved with the plot against JFK. I don't think there's evidence of that. But why are they there? There's something there about these guys that are significant. And so, you know, I try to explore and dig a little deeper because there are extensive files about these two individuals that are in the JFK files. One of them, Fernando Pinabaz Coburn, very interesting fellow. I mean, and he's got widespread connections. He was of operational interest of JM Wave. Of course, the whole JM Wave station down there with the CIA and their activities against Cuba, that makes him important. He obviously was a Cuban himself. That he was interested in their psych ward, that the psych war section was interested in utilizing him, at least up until 1963. Then they kind of say no. But what else about this guy? Well, he's an advisor to the Republican National Committee on Cuban Affairs. He's good friends with Richard Nixon. Okay, but then there's a darker side to this fellow. He's also members of a lot of right-wing, radical, we're going to talk about these folks later, Christian, extreme Christian, anti-communist crusades, connection with the John Birch Society. He's associated with General Edwin Walker. And, of course, we all know about the stuff with Walker and, you know, the supposed shot that maybe Oswald did or did not take at Walker and all that stuff. And I think, you know, that's something you can explore and debate later on in terms of what you think about that. But this guy's connected to a lot of people. And he's also one of those individuals that was circulating the narrative that we have to believe came from the CIA and others or right-wing groups that wanted to promote this idea that JFK's murder was a communist plot. So he's one of the guys spreading the story around him after the assassination. He has a lot of important connections. And I think he's an example, one example of some of what that could have been drawn from the Cuban exile community. And I want to go with this theme when we talk about what makes up a coup d'etat. What do you need to conduct a coup d'etat, whether it be 1963, 2021? You need radicalized people. You need people that are willing to do extreme things that have extreme views. That might be an oversimplified narrative on my part, but I think it's important to point out. Okay, so we've got this guy, but the next guy, well, I'm sure you may have heard of this individual. He's pretty notorious. Luis Posada Carriles, and if I get their names pronounce them incorrectly, forgive me for that. But this guy he has a long history, let's put it that way. you know, he has a long-running relationship with the CIA. He was given the cryptonym WK Scarlet-3. And up until a point, we'll talk about that in a minute. And then when you look at the hard thing about tracking some of these Cuban exiles in the files and other ways, and I know some of the researchers are familiar with this, is that these guys had so many aliases. I mean, it's hard to track them even. I mean, then one document on Posada had 5 aliases alone on this guy. I mean, he was involved in all sorts of things. He all sorts of jobs. He was a mechanic. He was this. He was that. He joined the United States military. He was training. For a short time, I think he believed he was an officer in the Army. So he has a military connection. And he's connected, obviously, with the CIA. And it's interesting about him. I mean, I've got a few quotes on him I wanted to talk about. Ultimately, early on, the CIA actually regarded him as not that bad a guy compared to with the Cuban exiles. I have a quote here from one officer who said, "He's not the typical kind of boom and bang individual. He's acutely aware of the international indications for ill-planned or overly enthusiastic activities against Cuba." Really? When we start to talk about some of these things that this guy did, and he's not one of the more radicals, who were the radical ones, the CIA, and if he wasn't? As I put up here, Peter Kornbluh of the Independent National Security Archives suggested that Posada was a creation of the CIA, created and unleashed a Frankenstein. Okay, by 1973, when the CIA got wind of the fact that they believed that Posada was running drugs, they disassociated with him. But that didn't stop that they thought he was a trafficker. But that didn't stop Posada from doing all sorts of anti-Castro type activities all the way into the 2000s. This guy obviously had enormous contempt for Castro and spent his whole life orchestrating attempts to either depose or assassinate Castro. He has been associated and long been suspected of being involved along with Orlando Bosch with the notorious bombing of a Cuban airliner in 1976. Some people believe that he was involved with the sabotage of that. He was involved with a mobster named Frank Lefty Rosenthal. He died at age 2018 at age 90 and is still regarded as a hero by many in the Cuban exile community. And it is a fact that CIA is still withholding documents on Posada. So again, what's the narrative here? I think he was involved with the planning of the Bay of Pigs. He wasn't there. Do I think he was somehow associated with the Kennedy affair? I don't really think so. But I think he typifies the folks that could be used or extracted in some sort of mission in terms of radicalization, extremism, in terms of people who could be utilized for those type of operations. And he's prominently in the JFK files. Okay. All right. Let's move on. So Antonio Viciana. Okay. Well, all right. Here's a guy, I debated whether even going through the stuff with Viciana. Again, I've spoken on it before. It's been a long-running debate in JFK community. I understand that about Viciana and his role, his connections to Phillips, whether he was telling the truth or not, if he changed his story. There's a whole lot of things there. I'm not going to get too deep into that. Because I think there's a couple different sides to Viciana, I think. Whether there was a Maurice Bishop, whether he actually met him or not, did he concoct that whole story? I know Dr. Newman suggested, and rightfully so, that the timeline when Viciana came out and finally admitted that he did meet with Bishop, aka David Atlee Phillips, that his timeline when he first met Phillips doesn't work. Did he concoct this story to cover up something in terms of the military's involved with the JFK? Those are all a ton of questions, I know. And I don't have time to delve into the night, and I don't claim to be an expert about it. I just want to bring out documents about Viciana for folks to see. And then they can judge for themselves about where Bisciana stands in the whole JFK picture, okay? And I think what is an important question, if, and a lot of people, a lot of folks feel like Alpha 66 was, again, focus on, if you want to have answers about the JFK assassination or any other coup d'etat, you focus on, you look for those radical enough to conduct those types of operations. Of course, many people believe that Alpha 66 fits the bill. I mean, they're the guys that could have been associated. And, you know, they conducted, and Bisciana was Alpha 66. They conducted all sorts of operations against Castro. I believe they were associated with the, thank God, the ill-fated, didn't work bazooka attack that would have killed Castro and Russian cosmonauts and probably started World War III. Thank God that one didn't work. So these guys were serious people. The question is, Bisciana and Alpha 66, who are they really connected to? Who can we trace them back to? And I think the documents do tell some stories in that respect that I would like to share with you. And here's one, and this is actually a 201 file that the CIA had on Antonio Bisciana. And there's no doubt that Bisciana was pursued by the CIA, and they were very interested in it. Yet, I think a couple of things that I have highlighted here indicate some things. The group was in contact with the CIA through a person named Joe, but the group they're talking about, Bisciana and Alpha 66, was not going to confide in the CIA, and they were taking precaution of avoiding CIA penetration. That's a pretty clear indication that Bisciana was trying to keep the CIA at arm's length. It very clearly says the next thing, that Bisciana said they needed agency help, but under no circumstances would the agency be identified with its activities. But yet, you go down further in the document, because this is kind of ambiguous, or, you know, both sides. It does, you know, there is a suggestion there that Bisciana wouldn't be above taking money from the CIA, and he would be willing, you know, if the CIA really wanted to talk to him, that he'd be willing to talk to someone in the agency sufficiently highly placed to make a commitment. Who would that be? Was that person David Atlee Phillips, a.k.a. Maurice Bishop? I have no idea. But it seems like Bisciana wants to keep the CIA at arm's length at the very least, but not above having some maybe financial help or support in some respects. Of course, Bisciana was a member of the United States Army. And yeah, I kind of think the documents tend to lean Alpha 66 and Bisciana towards the military, and maybe a deeper connection with them. And here's another one. I think this is another one we found in the documents. And then you look at it here at the top. First of all, it's interesting that the document's coming from J. Edgar Hoover. And it very clearly mentions Alpha 66. Who is the document directed towards? The United States Army. What is it about? Well, and I like the verbiage on this too. That it's, Hoover, I suppose Hoover wrote this memorandum, or somebody, so, you know, one of his top people. It's actually sending out a warning to the United States military that a Santos Tropicante, a well-known hoodlum, I love that characterization, hoodlum, wants to have Eloy Gutierrez Manoyo, who heads up, or who's an important figure in the Alpha 66, assassinated. Apparently, maybe the boys in Alpha 66 took some support from the mob and didn't pay them back or whatever, and there was a hit out on this Alpha 66 guy. And the important thing here is to note is that Hoover was contacting the Army about this problem. They weren't contacting the CIA. They weren't warning the CIA that one of the Alpha 66 guys was going to be killed. They're making sure the Army knows this. So I kind of take that to think, you know what? Alpha 66 might have had a closer association with the military than anything else. Okay, so if we take that presumption and we take it another step, I want to get into something I think is really important. Since we're talking about the military and its potential, if there are connections, and there are a lot of folks who, you know, a lot of the folks that have done the journey things have talked about military connections. Now, Casey's out there tonight. I know he's done a lot of work in this area. And folks have done a lot of work with this group I'm about to talk about. In fact, and I've got a little bit more than even, and I spoke of this in the spring at Dave's conference. I've got a little more in that respect to just kind of build on it. So we've got this small counterintelligence group called AXIE, and which is basically a group that was formed by the military for counterintelligence. And there is a history about them. There's been not a whole lot known, but if you look at, you know, just Google it, you can look up the Department of Defense's official history of AXIE, and it describes them as a small special purpose military unit created in 1960 to coordinate the intelligence activities of the Army Technical Services. I came across this quote from Fletcher Prouty. Of course, we know Prouty, liaison between military and the executive branch, you know, what's your opinions of him. But Prouty at one point made the quote that these guys actually was the black intelligence arm of the United States military, which says or suggests they were potentially some dangerous people. Here again, I come back to my theme about radicalization or willing to conduct extreme operations. If you want to look at who, if you want to find who might be involved in a coup d'etat at any level, in any place, you've got to find people who are capable of and willing to do extreme things. Okay? And I think this document that I came across is one of the more important documents that I found in the files that just characterizes exactly that. So it is coming straight from AXIE. It's going to the Chief of Staff of the United States Army. And you can see, I'm going to put the header on this particular document. Consequences of elimination or removal of Castro. So they're serious about what they want to do here. I mean, make no mistake about what their intentions might be. But let's go further. Let's look. So they come up with a list. In fact, you can't see it on the document. I have it cut off, but it says a list of ideas. Okay. And I love the fact that they put asterisks by a couple of things that are particularly maybe eye-opening or even disturbing. And you can clearly see number two, remove Castro and or other key political leaders by assassination, kidnapping, bribery, or placing a bounty on them. Now, to me, that's a pretty amazing thing to see. Because, and I've said this before, because, well, we know there were, 26 assassination plots by the CIA, supposedly orchestrated attempts against Castro. It's not like the agencies weren't and the CIA weren't and others attempting assassination. That's not the point here. I think the point is, though, that I think you would be hard-pressed to find actual CIA documents where they openly advocate assassination of Castro in particular or other leaders. Now, there may be some things out there. I think some people have mentioned things to me, maybe in an indirect way. But this agency, these guys in AXIE are saying point blank, let's go kill him. Let's go kill him. To me, that says something right there about who these people were all about and what their activities might entail. And I like the bottom of their number eight. Hey, they weren't above using biological warfare either on Cuba. These guys were willing to take some now, and they say, hey, except on humans, of course, we could just kill all the vegetables or vegetation in Cuba. These guys were willing to do some extreme stuff. You know, I think, and we're going to talk about, many of you are familiar with Northwoods, and we're going to get to that, Operation Northwoods, and the, you know, the operations they wanted to conduct against Castro or suggested to Kennedy, but this really goes beyond, I think, Northwoods. Okay. I think that would be my point here. Okay. Well, let's talk about some particular individuals associated with the Axie. And Dorothy Matlack, she's been high on my list lately. I know Casey just called me. That's what I wanted to bring up a couple of days ago, and found another little tidbit I want to kind of talk about Dorothy Matlack. And of course, some of you might be associated with or be aware of Matlack and her, where she's come up at. Well, right here, what do we have? We know she was Axie. I mean, that's the organization she belonged to. What do we have in front of you, though? This is a document from the CIA, a document to employ Dorothy Matlack. So here, once again, we're going to see this consistent interplay and exchange of individuals floating back and forth between the CIA and the military, and particularly Axie. And what jumps out at you, and I've said this before, and you've heard me speak of this before, you've heard this, is that, you look at the document at the top. This is dated 1958. Matlack is already a member of Axie. And the organization, according to the Department of Defense history, did not even exist until 1960. Is this some sort of clerical error, or is there some deeper meaning in that? Or was Axie so black, so under the radar that they were denial of their even existence? I don't know. But why does the Department of Defense history suggest the organization started? I think it'd be something I should contact the military about and follow through and say, hey, why do you guys say that organization started in '60? I've got proof that it started before that, and this is proof of that. The CIA wants her services, okay? And we'll get entailed into what those services were, okay? So, and I don't have the second page, but it clearly mentions, very eye-opening, that specific responsibilities listed on that CIA document for Dorothy Matlack, tracking defectors. Well, it doesn't take much to figure out that at that same time frame, Lee Harvey Oswald was in the Soviet Union. And can we speculate? I think it's beyond speculation. And again, Casey came up with something that he pointed out to me that might illuminate that bit. I won't mention that in a minute. But what was Matlack, as a part of Axie, one of those individuals tracking Oswald in Russia? Now, I put that in. I actually want to, before I let's save that for a minute. Let's go ahead and talk about this a minute. So, Casey talked, of course, Frank Brandstetter, I believe. And again, if I get some of this wrong, Casey, I know you're out there. You can correct me. Or otherwise nicknamed as Brandy. Well, Casey looked at his autobiography. He actually mentions Matlack. And it's almost like Matlack is like a wheelhouse or a clearinghouse for through a whole range of things, information abroad and at home. She's a key player, I think, in the whole affair in terms of tracking possibly Oswald, and all the goings on with Axie, I think, are important to note. And I'll come back to this little article about her. I think I may have gotten this out of place, but let's go on. I want to talk about Sam Cale. Now, before I get to him, let's go ahead. I know, I'm sorry for being confusing, but we all know that Matlack also in April of '63 would meet with one George de Morenshield. In April of '63, and in that meeting was also with a CIA officer named Zionkowski. I hope I didn't butcher that name. But of course, we know George the Marshall was pretty much that we all feel like was the man handling Lee Harvey Oswald in Dallas. And there, by chance, here's Matlack, a CIA officer, meeting with George the Marshall, supposedly to put him in touch with a Haitian businessman named Charles, that, you know, that had all that cover stuff. But I know that Bill Simpy found an article that he written a few years ago. I just want to read the quote about what really may have gone on with Matlack and Ziankowski. And it states here, I quote from one of Bill's articles, it says, Matlack and Ziankowski, and forgive me if I'm butchering that name, had the opportunity to meet with George the Marshall, his wife Jeannie, and Charles. Charles was unexpectedly called away by a so-called Mr. Green, thanks to some machinations by Ziankowski. The debriefing specialists, Matlack and Ziankowski, now had the DeMornshalls all of themselves, which provided them an opportunity to finish any small talk about George's time in Texas and their time with a certain family of Soviet defectors. So to me, that really makes, you know, Matlack important. By the way, Ed Tatro gave me a piece of important research with Ziankowski that he pointed out that there is some evidence or speculation that it was Ziankowski who rented the same P.O. box in Dallas that was used by Lee Harvey Oswald immediately after the assassination. So I want to put that little point of interesting tidbit about Ziankowski. So all these things going on with Matlack. And so I found this thing up. You know, I just tried to do a little research on her. And I've got a little kind of theories about this. This is actually from the Department of the Army, and by that time she had in fact been deceased. But Matlack got all sorts of awards from the military. You know, she received the Department of Defense Distinguished Civilian Service Award in June of 72 for exceptional contributions in the intelligence collection field. Distinguished member of the MI Corps, in the MI, whatever that is, Hall of Fame. She passed away in 91 at age 85. If she was a football player, man, they would have retired her jersey, I guess you could say. And I think about those things and the folks that we have suspicions about in the JFK Assassination Research Committee community. Whenever you see these things happen where these people get the golden parachutes out the door, or they receive the awards or all the commendations I see a little bit of that when William Harvey retired and Helms went out of his way to meet with him and make sure, you know, how proud he was of the service and everything else. That, you just wonder about when they get the awards going out the door, what do they know? What secrets are in the closet that they know about that they took with them to the grave possibly? So that's my information on Axie and a little bit. Then we want to go ahead. Well, there's actually a bit more. Of course, Sam Cale's a guy that we talk about a lot. Another one, Cale, I believe, was in 59, was in the Cuban embassy, and he was interconnected with CIA types down there in Cuba before they closed down the embassy when Castro took over. He was connected with Phillips and people. You know, at one point, Cale, also being Axie, even made a comment that, you know, I can't even tell you whether I'm working for which agency I'm working for. Again, Cale's a prime example, if nothing else, of that interconnectivity between the CIA and this particular organization, Axie, in the United States military.
David?
Yeah.
I don't want to interrupt you, but I think that some people might want to know what the MI course is. That's the military Intelligence Corps, and it's a intelligence branch of the United States Army. That's what that is, MI Corps.
And I'm glad,
Intelligence Corps.
And I'm thank you, David. I'm glad you filled in the blanks because I was not aware of that. So thanks for filling in those blanks. So, okay. And then I'll go over one more thing, and I think it might be a good time to maybe, you know, well, we'll see how we go here before we, I think I might want to at least take one more break and, you know, give you folks a chance to take a breath here. But a lot of the folks here, and I know Casey spent a lot of time on this, others, you know, and I do not claim to be an expert on the whole thing in terms of, you know, the so-called Higgins memo and what that may imply and the potential involvement of the United States military. I know Dr. Newman a few weeks ago gave an amazing presentation on a lot of this stuff. But I just want to point out to you that I did find a document in the National Archives that did validate, you know, there's other validation of that meeting, the so-called Higgins memo, of this meeting that took place between the CIA and the Joint Chiefs, in particular General LeMay, who was standing in for Maxwell Taylor, and what was discussed there. Now, of course, the Higgins memo associated with a Colonel Higgins who took notes, who maybe went far more in depth than what this cover document has. And unfortunately, and I've looked, and I would encourage others. One of the things that Casey told me is, hey, what can you find the rest of this doc? Sometimes when you get some of these documents in the National Archives, you get one page and that's it out of three. And unfortunately, at this point, this is only the page one. There are more pages of this document, and boy, would I like to see them. But to this point, I have not located them. And it's basically a cover thing. And, of course, again, if you know the details, you know, associated with that, Des Fitzgerald, CIA, is talking about changing conditions in Cuba, that he believes Cuba's Castro's hold is weakening. There might be an opportunity to conduct some more operations. You know, and maybe is this some sort of the beginning of some cooperation in this respect between the CIA and military? And, you know, the Higgins memo actually mentions the discussion of something called Operation Valkyrie, which, of course, if you know your history, was the actual assassination plot that ultimately failed against Adolf Hitler in 1944. But what apparently Higgins suggested, or what was discussed there, was that maybe the same kind of operation could be used against Castro, where different elements of the military could be even utilized to conduct an assassination, and even without their knowledge, they could have, certain things could have been turned on at the same. And that was actually what happened with Valkyrie, which may well have happened, been successful if the bomb had done its job and killed Hitler. And so, you know, the whole thing was, okay, was Valkyrie ultimately an operation that suggested that Castro that could have been turning against JFK? Those are the questions, again. And of course, LeMay is certainly a very suspicious character among the Joint Chiefs. We're going to be talking about them later in that respect. So let's go on a bit here. Let's see what I've got. And I'm trying to pick the right spots to take breaks. And I think this is a good time before I want to start to make this kind of connection and move fast forward 58 years later. And again, this could be, I understand this is more political. Some folks might have different views about this, but I don't like running away from stuff like this. I always like to make the connections between the then and now. And is there a then and now? Is there a connection? You know, can we find parallels between what happened in Dallas and what happened in January of this year in our capital? So is this maybe a good time to take another break, though?
Let's go ahead and take a break and see if our audience members have questions for you.
And I might just get up for a moment and get a drink and come right back after the questions, if that's okay.
That would be fine, David.
Okay.
All right. So does anybody have any questions for David on what he just talked about?
Yeah, David, just Casey again.
Yeah.
I'm trying to figure out who actually said this. I think it might have been Jim Lazar, but I'm not sure if it was him now or not. But they were talking about the document that you just were talking about in 1963 in September.
Right.
The Higgins memo.
Right.
And I think he said something like the idea that it's not necessarily a smoking gun, but it's pretty darn close to it.
Correct.
Because it's one of those things you sit back and you can read a lot of stuff into that, but at the same time, there are people that will sit back and say the term blowback, and the term blowback would be, okay, this was supposedly going to be designed to take out Castro, but and that was just right around the corner, because you go to September to October and then you get to November. Did that same thing take place in Dallas? And I think that's an excellent question, but to try to find documentation on that, I don't think you're going to find anything. And I may be wrong. We may have to go to individuals, people who have died and they've left stuff. Documents in libraries and maybe their diaries or something of a nature that said this is what took place. But I think a lot of that, if it's with Axie, and I think a lot of it is, a lot of that stuff will either be written down in code or not written down at all. And I just wanted to make that comment.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, unfortunately, I think there might be, at least there has been so far, I know a lot of you guys have been looking at this stuff. I know Bill Kelly's obviously done a lot of stuff with the whole military and the Axie people. I've relied a lot on some of the things he's written about it. But, I just kind of got late in the game when I started coming across these handful of documents that were in the National Archives about them. But you're right. It only takes you so far. I mean, but like you mentioned, and I'm sure people are aware of this, and, I quote from my article that they discussed the idea of using this plot against Castro, and yet, suspiciously, this detailed study has never surfaced in any documents, even when requested by, like you mentioned, Jim Lazar and Dan Alcorn. They've tried to go after and try to find that document that might show what did that detailed study about Valkyrie really end up with. So there was a suggestion that it was out there, but nobody's found it, right? I think that's the way to put it right now, right, Casey? I mean, in that respect.
Yeah, I would agree with you, but it lays open a whole bunch of different speculation, and the speculation is pretty heavy in the area of that. Well, could this have been the plan, the operational plan that blew back into the United States through Axie and the Joint Chiefs of Staff and took out JFK? Well, and I have to give praise to the researchers who are going through these tremendous amounts of documents, but at the same time, I'm not really sure if you're going to find documents that are related to this. So basically, I think what we have left is we have speculation, and I know that we don't want speculation. We want actual documents that lead us to something that we can pinpoint and say this is exactly what took place. And I think little by little, once we start seeing the relationship between people like James Angleton and people like Dorothy Matlock, and when you start seeing that inner workings of the CIA and who actually handled Oswald, maybe just on paper, but even if they were just on paper, it was one of those things that you sit back and say, okay, there is a paper trail with Dorothy Matlock and the CIA and Axie. And that was never brought out in the Warren Commission or the House Senate Select Committee.
Correct. And I agree with you when we I wonder how many times I've made that statement, like you just said, Casey, but what are we left to do but to speculate when we start to try to understand what happened in Dallas? I think because of the lack of a legitimate investigation, and I'm going to talk about, you know, I always try to talk about that at the end, you know, I want to give my viewpoints about, you know, the whodunit part of it. We all try to, and how far we can or can't go. But just, you know, if there's been no legitimate investigation, Casey, right, what are we left to do but to speculate? So we do. But sometimes our speculation is based upon strong facts or strong narratives that lead us in a direction too. It's, you know, it's not like we're just pulling these things out of thin air, right? I mean,
absolutely.
We have some things that look suspicious with Axie and the military, and I'm going to get more and more of these things as we go along here. So, anyway, anything else?
Anybody else have any questions for David? Okay, well, I think we're going to take a couple-minute break so that way David can get some water, and we'll be right back. So
I'll be right back. Okay.
Well, while he is getting something to drink, again, everybody that is in attendance, if you have not visited ProdigyFK.com recently, there have been some updates. There should be more updates coming in the near future. There'll also be a journey meeting in September, which is just about a day away. It will probably be the first weekend. I will put the date up just as soon as we finalize the date for it, for our journey meeting, our regular one on a Saturday, and then also announce who our spotlight speaker will be for the month of September. During that journey meeting, we should be able to have quite a few details of our global conference that will be happening November 13th and 14th this year. It's the weekend before Assassination Weekend down in Dallas, when all the other groups have their conferences. I understand that Judith Baker's going to have a conference, so is Kappa, and I've heard details about JFK Lancer. So those should all be the weekend after we have our conference. And again, you'll find those details at ProdigyFK.com under the Events tab. Also under the Events tab, some of you guys might know, and this also goes to people that are watching this in replay, we record all our Zoom meetings. We post them usually within 12 to 14 hours after the event, if not sooner. The replays are there for your enjoyment in case you happen to need to take a break and you miss out on something. You can go back and look at it again and see what you missed. Also, the chat log is always, if there is a chat log for the journey meetings and the spotlight series, which most of the time that there is, those are listed there as well. Plus the links that are shared from some of our attendees, those links are always searchable. We also have a MP3 section, so if you want to download the audio-only file and take it with you to listen on an MP3 player, your cell phone, in your car, you're able to do that as well. And again, all that is under the Events tab at ProdigyFK.com. I see David's back with us, so I'm going to turn it back to him, and he can continue his presentation. Go ahead, David.
Okay. Well, before I leave, we were talking about the potential involvement of the military you know, in terms of looking at, you know, the possible assassination of JFK and what connections might be, a kind of a, if you will, kind of 7 days in May scenario, of course, with associating with that movie. And there's no doubt that when you take a look at the Joint Chiefs, and again, I think I'm going to get around a Operation Northwoods in my documents. I will get there. I mean, you know, we'd like to, there's some folks there that raise suspicion. I mean, LeMay, of course, as a true Kennedy hater who openly challenged the president during the Cuban Missile Crisis. You know, some researchers actually believe LeMay might have been at the autopsy. And that's, again, we're back to speculation around how much of that's grounded in fact. I thought it was interesting that Dr. Newman, you know, discusses General Maxwell Taylor, and I draw a quote from him, who's considered Taylor, of course, who was supposed to be a friend of the Kennedy family, but that Dr. Newman considers Taylor almost to be a quote-unquote Trojan horse, which is an interesting way to put it. But again, I keep coming back to this theme, and it will segue into what I want to talk about next, is the idea of what a coup d'etat means and the significance and importance of finding some level of radicalization and willingness to do extreme things. I think there's a clear indication of that in the Joint Chiefs in 1963, and in terms of being willing to participate in something of that along those lines. So we move forward to January 6, 2021. And this is, and again, I say this is politically charged. And folks might have different viewpoints about it. I understand. But, I've talked with a couple, I think I mentioned earlier, I talked with a couple friends about it. You know, this is something maybe worth exploring. And, you know, I remember the night after January 6th occurred, there's Northwoods, I finally got it in there, but where I had a conversation with Mal Hyman. The professor from South Carolina who's written a great book on the media of the JFK assassination, great speaker, great guy. I appreciate him. He's spoke at several of my conferences. And I remember when we talked about that night after this whole thing went down, and one of the things that we kind of came together is the idea, well, maybe what's going on here? Was there any security stripping? Some things that happened that make us flash back to 1963. Of course, we know, you know, some of the things with the Secret Service and the fact that they weren't, you know, protecting their client in 1963. So I started to dig into this, and of course, some of this stuff just comes out of today's newspapers and news. You can put it all together yourself, and you can make these kind of comparisons about where maybe Dallas, there is a kind of a connection or parallel, and maybe things they're not the same thing. But I think what is clear is that we can define what is a coup d'état. Is defined as the seizure and removal of a government, its powers. It is an illegal and unconstitutional seizure of power by a political faction, the military, potentially, or a dictator. That is the definition of a coup d'etat. And so can we look at these things and what happened and put that characterization as a coup d'etat attempt? I mean, was it just a bunch of ragtag extremist Trump followers who, you know, got all excited and decided to riot and spontaneously have this event in terms of storming the Capitol? Was there more organization than that? Can we really look at this in terms of plotting, planning? And a lot of those things remain to be seen. And as I said, it depends on maybe in some cases your party affiliation. Of course, some folks on the right think maybe it was orchestrated by Antifa or Black Lives Matter, although there's simply no evidence of that. There are congressmen that, you know, seem to be in denial about this sort of thing and what happened. One Georgia congressman referred to the insurrectionists as tourists visiting the Capitol. Really? A lot of folks, some folks died there a lot of destruction of property, and a lot of people were in dire positions at one point for just to be a tour of the Capitol. Even Trump made the point that they were phrasing the rioters as loving and patriotic, as great people, that they were ushered in by the police. There was hugging and kissing. Boy, you hear some of the accounts from the Capitol Police, and then you don't, that's 180 degrees in the opposite direction in that respect. But you know, I think it's what's most important here. Whatever, you know, what, because I'm a history person, I want to make connections between the then and now, and I constantly do it in the classroom, and when this all stuff went down, I could not ignore this. I could not leave this moment behind or let it go. And I think it's regardless of where we stand on what it was or what it was, and I don't think you can just pass it off and say it's time to move on. I mean, it's dangerous to do that. And I'll get back to that more in a minute. You know, this it's almost like for some, though, it's just like it never happened. And I kind of, you know, to make the connection between JFK, what happened to JFK, one thing that came to mind was the comment that New Orleans DA Jim Garrison, you know, when he was doing his investigation, all the resistance he got against it and the infiltration and criticism in the press, that at one point, of course, that Garrison said that someday they would proclaim that JFK never existed. That you guys are pretending like at one point that JFK was never even alive. That you just want to shove all this under the rug. And I think we can make a little bit of that parallel now here too, that if it's something that can't be ignored. If we are a democracy, if we are or any semblance thereof, you know, these are sorts of things that can destroy democracy. And I would suggest that all of us believe, of course, that what happened in Dallas was definitely a coup d'etat and badly damaged our democracy. I don't think we totally lost it, but we'll get more into that in a minute. But one of the things we can look at is, of course, a military parallel. What about military involvement? We've discussed this already. To me, there's clear indications if we bounce back to 1962, that's where I'm bringing the whole Operation Northwoods thing, which of course many of you are familiar with already, that were indications that in 1962, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, just how extreme they were. I mean, Northwoods was a series of recommendations of the Kennedy administration. Here we are. What do we do with Cuba? What do we do with Castro? How far are we willing to go to do almost extreme or insane even operations, false flag and covert operations that could potentially provide a pretext for invading Cuba? They made all sorts of proposals to Kennedy about, you know, they'd shoot down an airliner and blame Castro, blow up a ship in Guantanamo Bay and have a Remember the Maine moment and blame it on Castro, invade Cuba. These all things were coming from Lyman Lindenser, who, of course, I think Dr. Newman talked about in his presentation a couple of weeks ago in great detail just how extreme Lindenser was. And, of course, they even went so far with Operations Northwoods to even suggest that if John Glenn in 1962, of course, the first man to orbit in space for the United States, if that rocket blew up on the pad, which is a very real chance it might have. Hey, let's just go ahead and blame it on Castro and invade Cuba for that one. These are the kind of things that they were actually bringing to McNamara and the Kennedys to do. It's not hard to understand that Kennedys just, you know, and McNamara just dressed them down and humiliated them. What are you coming to me with this stuff for? You know, but it shows of a level extremist. So why am I bringing this up? Well, let's go back to today. Where do the Joint Chiefs stand on all the things that happened in January or even before? And I think you see something that's totally opposite, I think. Maybe fortunately for the United States. I mean, the behavior of the Joint Chiefs in regard to some of these goings on before and after what happened in January are entirely different. In fact, the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, actually made it clear in the summer before that we are not going to engage in anything or have any role in the elections. And it's clear that Milley had deep concerns. Of course, he's the guy that, you know, that Trump had, you know, parade across the street and go to the church during the Black Lives Matter things. I think he was potentially embarrassed by all that thing, and I don't think he had a real high regard for Trump after that. But he had deep and clear concerns. It's pretty amazing when you read this stuff, and of course, a lot of this came out with the book "I Alone Can Fix It" that the Washington Post reporters wrote about the potential that there for a coup d'état in case that Trump did not win the election. They were serious about it. In fact, that quote that came out says they may try, but they're not going to effing succeed. To me, this is one of the most amazing things for those of us that think about the JFK assassination. This thing just jumped right out at me. Where Milley's saying behind the scenes, you can't do this without the military. You can't do this without the CIA and the FBI. We're the guys with the guns. I see that is an enormously, for those of us who see the same thing that happened in Dallas, an amazingly ironic statement that Milley made. And thankfully, you know, they were on a different side than the Joint Chiefs were in 1963 in regards to all this. Okay. Well, let's keep. So Milley talked about it, the potential for a Reichstag moment, where that supporters of Trump might be like Hitler's brown shirts in the streets. I mean, he was genuinely worried about what might happen. And what the military might have to deal with. Okay. So, and then I've already talked about this again, so I've already brought it up, the fact that Mal and I talked about potential security stripping. But there is, you know, the day after the assassination, we hadn't looked at these things, but I went back and looked at some things, and some stuff was made apparent in the press. And I do find this really disturbing. This document, and this is a memorandum for the secretary, but by the acting, Secretary of Defense. Again, first thing you have to remember is after Trump lost the election, he decapitated much of the civilian leadership in December, or right after the election, in the military, and replaced them with Trump loyalists. And you had to worry, what's going on? And I can remember that. I say, if you're a lame duck president, why do you go to the bother to start stripping personnel out of the military leadership and start putting your own people in? What are you up to? And one of those people was Miller, the acting Secretary of Defense. And this is a directive. Take note, 2 days before the assassination. And we can understand maybe maybe there's an innocent explanation for all this, but you read through these things. When they send out orders to the National Guard without any authorization, you are not authorized to be issued any weapons, any ammunition, any bayonets, any helmets, any body armor, or interact physically with protesters, employ any riot control agency, don't use any air assets. I mean, they were literally tying the hands of the National Guard before this event. Why? I don't think that's a question that has to be answered when you start to question about what went on that day. Of course, we know if we make the connection, we flip back to Dallas. And again, there's plenty of evidence. You only need to read Vince Palomera and all his stuff and associated with the Secret Service and their, you know, not being where they were supposed to be on that day in Dallas and other things. You can read into all that and question those things and see maybe a potential parallel. I don't know. And then, of course, when the whole thing goes down, the D.C. National Guard, head of William Walker, he's ready to go, but he's sitting in his their trucks waiting for orders. They waited. I think they asked 17 times to go in to try to quell the riot, and was denied 17 times by Miller and by de facto Trump, who had the authority at any time and never really did it, send anybody in. And so then ultimately it has to be Pence, who was the target of the insurrections, who ultimately gave the order to send in the guard. So again, I'm just trying to look at these things closely and what are the elements of potentially of a coup, what it means, what it might mean. And, you know, there is some parallel between, I think, another thing we gotta have to look at between Dallas and what happened in January in D.C. with the participation of the radical, potential radical right wing, again, radicalization. There were all sorts of groups that were congregating at the Capitol with. And so, you know, there might be some suggestion, well, that was all kind of an organic thing. Yeah, but these guys were ready for, they everything but pistols and guns, possibly. And even in one situation, I'll mention in a minute, one of those groups, when we talk about the Proud Boys, the Oath Keepers, the Three Percenters, the Boogaloo Boys, you know, the FBI director said these people are dangerous people, that they were metastasizing our country. These people were integrated into the crowd, and they were ready for action. I think that's clear to say, you know, and I think we can see that. And of course, they had connections with the KKK, white supremacy people. And guess what? We know that in Dallas, we go back 58 years, and there are some clear indications of some of right-wing extremism, you know, peripherally around the event in Dallas. And of course, that comes to mind. Of course, many JFK researchers are certainly familiar with one Joseph Miltier, who was, if you look into him, he was caught on audio tape by longtime FBI informant Willie Somerset, who had successfully infiltrated some of the many radical right-wing groups were apparent back in 1963 in America. And Somerset would describe Miltier as the most violent-minded man in America. That's a pretty serious guy. Miltier traveled around the country, establishing connections with the White Citizens Council, John Birch's, the Ku Klux Klan, the Nazi Party. And, of course, there was a conversation taken between Miltier and Somerset 13 days before the assassination, where it was pretty obvious that Miltier predicted that JFK would be shot from an office from a building with a high tower rifle, and somebody would be arrested to throw the public off. And I just bring these things up because these things flash back when I hear about these groups that were in D.C. and I think back, you know, I think, okay, some of this stuff was around the whole affair in Dallas too. Okay. So again, if you're looking for historical parallels, of course, there's Miltier there. And of course, some people have looked, you know, that story's been out there a long time. I'm aware of that. We do have to mention one. I said the Joint Chiefs really wanted to kind of stay away from this whole thing. But we, of course, there's General Flynn, of course, who was one general, though not no longer former national security advisor for Trump, who really went off the deep end. Of course, he was prosecuted and pardoned for, you know, conducting, you know, foreign influence operations and this and that. And I found it interesting that not long ago that Flynn said that there should be some sort of Myanmar, you know, what happened with the coup in Myanmar, I didn't say that correctly, formerly Burma, that's the easy way to put it, you know, that something like that we need something like that in the United States. It may, how extreme have some of those folks have gotten in our country? I don't think we can ignore that. Not at all. You know, was it a bungled attempt by some people that had no chance of success? Yeah, that's true. And if we assume that the coup in Dallas was successful and this one was not, should we, how serious we would take it? I've got here some quotes from Tim Snyder, who is a historian, Yale historian, who predicted as early as 2017 that Trump, if he didn't get elected, would attempt a coup, if necessary, to stay in power because of his authoritarian instincts, that it's going to be messy. And he also points out that if we just ignore this, if we say, okay, it's not that big a deal, or it's not really wasn't a coup at all, that, you know, I like what Snyder, that quote we have there, that a failed coup is a practice for a successful one. That's very true. I mean, you could, another historical comparison of what happened in D.C. I don't know if I've got a slide on that. Yeah, the Hitler's 1923 beer hall push. And, you know, at the time when Hitler attempted to take power in Germany, it was viewed as a mere clown show. They didn't take it seriously then either. His attempts to result in seizing power in the Weimar Republic, including radicalization of people, encouraged willingness to commit violence. Same thing. You know, you make these parallels. And let's keep in mind that Hitler only spent 9 months in jail. He's back out. You wonder how this is all going to play out. These people that, you know, how far they go with the folks that were behind this, how seriously they take it, who might be prosecuted, how long they spend in jail, and what are the repercussions. I think there are lessons to be learned here, I think, in many ways. And that's why I wanted to take the time to kind of do a little bounce back and forth between Dallas and D.C., if you will, and take it for what it's worth. So let's kind of go back. I want to bounce back and find and kind of wrap this thing up and go back. You know, I'm always talking about history and can we find some historical truth in the murder of JFK? That's what we're always seeking. That's what Casey and I were talking about earlier. How far can we go or can't we? And I make a statement here that despite the overwhelming collection of evidence that repudiates the idea of a lone assassin and points toward a conspiracy, what is most difficult is gaining validation of that truth within our institutions. And even as late as 2021, it still proves to be difficult. There are those that, you know, basically stick their heads in the sand in terms of our institutions, our media, our government, or other. There are those who refuse to engage any discussion at all deemed to be conspiratorial or not publicly accepted. That's very difficult. It makes it harder for those of us who want to bring light to or truth to this story. Is it impossible? Is there a day where that might change? I can't say there won't be. I always make this parallel. I look, you know, if you were watching 60 Minutes last night, they brought up the reality that suddenly the government has become all open about the possibility or existence of UFOs, when that was probably fringe conspiracy nonsense for so long that no one was willing to accept. But I think what happened is ultimately those facts that couldn't be denied, those numbers of sightings and reports that could not be dismissed away by legitimate pilots and people in the military, that they finally had to say, okay, there's something there. At what point will Americans or our institutions finally say about Dallas, okay, there was something there? I mean, in our lifetimes, I don't know. I know that the JFK assassination badly damaged, as I said earlier, but I don't think destroyed our democratic institutions. We have some semblance of that. But it certainly did, however, allow the national security state to kind of assert itself, as we know. I mean, in terms of dominating, I mean, the Vietnam War comes on top of the JFK assassination. I don't think there's any accident that those things are in some ways connected in its ability to assert its will on the American public. yet, you know, maybe there's still possibilities that there's pushback against that as well. I mean, that the American public can have, if they exert their will enough, some semblance of democracy if we're willing to fight for it. Okay. So historical truth about the JFK assassination, and this seems vague. I mean, I don't know. I still think it's the best answer. I quoted, you know, I mentioned my friend Ed Tatro a lot. He's a great researcher, you know, and I think, you know, we've talked about, you know, how do we come to terms with Dallas, you know, with what we have and the facts we have. And I think the best potential explanation is that Dallas was a collaboration of the most powerful people in the country, not all the most powerful people, but there were certainly powerful people in this country across the lines of power who saw Kennedy as a deadly enemy to their interests and were willing to act upon it. And whether that be residing in Texas or in the Joint Chiefs or in the CIA, and that somehow there was a convergence in that. I think that's the best way to explain it. If you've read my article that I wrote a few years ago called Nexus, I invite you to go to my JFK Historical Group. You know, I've got a blog there, a long article about a new witness at that time that kind of came out of the woodwork named Gordon Ferry, and you may have heard of him. He's kind of a very interesting, intriguing character. I probably spent maybe 30 hours interviewing via phone and a lot. He's a very interesting guy who had a lot of inside connections, is the best way to describe it. He was a United States Marine Corps as a teenager. He was a world-class sharpshooter, which put him in a position to be put on a detailed protection for JFK even Eisenhower as a teenager, and then JFK gave him a 50-year security clearance. He kind of educated himself. He went on from the military to be involved in finances and banking, and then described himself as kind of being in the heart of the military-industrial complex. It's a fascinating read, and he has a lot of documents to back up his position. Now, he also has a lot of opinions about things. I don't know if I necessarily agree on all of them, but he is an interesting character who he said a few years ago, what he described as came out of the bunker. And we've talked a lot about the JFK assassination, and he does have some knowledge about that he believes about that. And he described it as, you know, the first thing that came to mind, his reaction when JFK was hit was, which group? He's told me that many times, because he knew there were so many powerful enemies and powerful places that lined up against Kennedy. So, that is kind of a synopsis of where I know it's a broad synopsis, but let's move on. You know, if we want to drill down on this further, you know, and again, I'm kind of going back to classroom thing here a little bit, but in history as I wrap through this, if you, someone asks you, which I get this all the time, I know a lot of the folks that have it, you know, so who killed JFK? You know, I get that like five times a week, my students, you know, who killed, you know, and of course, first thing I say is like, how much time do you have? You know, I mean, are you willing to sit down and listen to me for a few minutes? Because there's a complex answer to all this. But maybe a good starting point might be the Texas School Book Depository, and for a lot of reasons. I mean, you know, obviously this is where Oswald, if you believe that Oswald was, as he said he was, the patsy, that he was the fall guy, well, how did he get there? Who put him there? And start from there. And that's why we go straight to who owned the Texas School Book Depository, D.H. Byrd. And I mean, if you take the time, and of course, many of you folks really know all this already, but wow. I mean, if you, anyone who takes the time to look at the connections between D.H. Byrd and so many powerful enemies of Kennedy, I mean, you go down the list. I mean, he was a co-owner of Ling Timko Vought. He was a real key figure in the military-industrial complex. He was a key figure in the Texas oil industry. He was closely connected to all the Texas power brokers. oil barons, the military-industrial complex, and Texas politicians. He was a close ally of Lyndon Johnson and John Conley. He was associated with the right-wing Sweet 8F group, including George and Herman Brown Root, Brown and Root, Bell Helicopters, key players in America's military-industrial complex. He also included powerful right-wing oil men that he was close to, Clinton Murchison, Sid Murchison, H.L. Hunt, all fierce defenders of the oil depletion allowance. He was a close friend of General Curtis LeMay. Obviously, the Civil Air Patrol he started that Lee Oswald was in. So what does all that mean? I think, first of all, I use this term. You've heard the term degrees, 3 degrees, 2 degrees of separation. In essence, there are 2 degrees of separation between some of the most powerful right-wing forces in America, all who had contempt for Kennedy, and the man who was set up to take the fall for his death. They were one person removed. As Byrd as being a link to all those people, the man who hired Lee Harvey Oswald. I think you have to look at that. I think you can't ignore that, and you can start from there. You know, when you look at the JFK assassination, and of course, Oliver Stone's an important person in all this, and obviously the movie JFK, which came out 30 years ago and really, stirred the pot, so to speak. Very importantly, it led to the release of a lot of important documents. And of course, Stone just released his JFK Revisited, and we're all interested to see that. Of course, it was been reviewed, it's been looked at, and it's come back around once again. And I think back on that, and Stone's movie obviously was subject to criticism on a lot, on some levels. Yet, we have to take into consideration that, Stone didn't have access to all the documents that we talked about, some of which we talked about tonight. But his movie was responsible for releasing many of those documents, which makes it very important. But as we go around here and we look at these things and we look at what happened in Dallas, I sometimes contemplate whether, was Stone really ever that far from the truth? I mean, you take a quote from this movie, which he obviously, I think he's injecting his opinions about there at one point in the movie when New Orleans DA Jim Garrison, of course, played by Costner, he's meeting with his folks and he suggests that what we have here is a coup d'etat with Lyndon Johnson waiting in the wings. And I see that quote and that just sticks in my mind is this is what Dallas really was about, that maybe Stone really wasn't that far from the truth. But, when we look in the context of history and what the JFK assassination is all about, and seeking justice, which we all think we need to try to do, and we seek, and maybe it's an impossible thing that we won't ever get all the way there. Like Casey mentioned earlier during the break, that we're left with holes, speculation, or resistance because there's enough facts out there that really indicate, that we know that something sinister happened in Dallas. I don't think that can be disputed. We lack historical validation, though, and that's an ongoing problem, or not historical, but validation by our institutions. But, if we are to remain a democracy, we can't just let these things slide. I don't think we can let Dallas, November 22nd, 63 slide and just say, let's move on. I don't think we can, the event in January, we can just let slide either. Again, I'll give Mal Hyman, because my friend, I remember the last conversation I had with him, he mentioned this quote like 4 times in the conversation, so it stuck in my head. Eternal vigilance is the price of liberty. And that was a quote attributed to Thomas Jefferson somewhat, although I've read some historical interpretations where they're not really certain where that statement arisen. But there's no doubt it was a commonly used terminology or term or phrase used early in our nation's history. Eternal vigilance is the price of liberty. That if we're not vigilant, if we don't work in our democracy, if we don't fight for the truth, we won't have that, or a republic, as you know, you see that often used quote from Benjamin Franklin. We have a republic if you can keep it. People are always quoting that. But I look, you look at that quote a little further, and it goes on. What also Franklin said after that, I think it's very important. The next thing that Franklin said when he stood on the steps after the Constitution had been written, he said, it's our responsibility to keep it. It is. It's for all of us. And part of that responsibility to maintain any type of free and open society is based upon the simple idea of justice. And I think that's why all of us, you know, are in this thing. I think, I don't know how many of those of you are out there, and we're not big in number. I mean, researchers, but I think we have this overriding idea that we're seeking justice, whether or not we get it or not, whether it happens in our lifetime. And I want to talk about that for a minute. You know, the recent quote, you know, again, this came from the one of Trump's, you know, the Colonel Vindman, the whistleblower who came forward during Trump's impeachment, and, you know, pointed out that, you know, some things that, you know, the scandal with Ukraine, that and he was asked in a congressional hearing that if he feared retribution for coming forward. And he said, this is America, right matters, which is a great quote. I love that quote. But I have to say, right matters in America sometimes, but it hasn't all the time, you know? I mean, it's important to know that if we don't get to some resolution of our past, you know, that the fact that the murder of John Kennedy was one of the gravest injustices in our 245-year history and remains unresolved. It's an open wound. And for many of us, that's a frustrating thing. It's a frustrating thing for me. And, you know, none of us are going to live forever, you know, and maybe the likelihood is that we don't ever find that justice for what happened in Dallas. Or maybe it's sometimes passed for a lifetime. And because I brought that up, because I want to kind of jump into one last little history thing for you, because I am a history guy. You know, this is what I was just saying, you know, that this justice may not be found in our lifetime. Let's go on, because I want to talk about within the context. I'm going to jump to a completely different thing here at the end. And one of my favorite characters in history is Eleanor Roosevelt. And the more I read about her, I just think she is just so amazing. Without a doubt, one of the most amazing, courageous figures in the 20th century. And she stood for justice throughout her lifetime. She stood for those who had no voice. She was really one of the first people in any position of power that was a civil rights crusader for African Americans. She was decades ahead of her time. Nobody, even Roosevelt, her husband, didn't have the courage to come forward and fight for civil rights for African Americans. She did. I mean, the story about Marian Anderson, the famous African American opera singer who was denied an opportunity to sing by the Daughters of the American Revolution. And I believe it was 1939, Roosevelt responded by allowing Marian Anderson to give a concert on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial before 75,000 people. You know, you're talking about sticking it back in the face of someone. Eleanor Roosevelt did in that case. She fought. There would have been no heroics of the Tuskegee Airmen if it wasn't for Eleanor Roosevelt, who went down, who lobbied for them, who went down and flew in a plane with one of those guys and made sure they got there and fought. She was so far ahead of her time. And she fought a lot of battles. She won a lot of battles. Early in World War II, when things were at their worst, She flew into a war zone in the Pacific when they told her not to. She risked her life. She went and saw American soldiers. She saw how bad it was. She came back and fought for and got one of the most important civil rights legislations in American history passed, called the, not civil rights, the GI Bill, which maybe built the American middle class, one of the most important legislations in American history. She gets a lot of credit for a lot of stuff. But one thing she failed at, though, was she was one of the few people who stood in the breach after World War II, or after Pearl Harbor, when the country was in a hysteria, understandably the fearful of an invasion by the Japanese on the West Coast. What do we do with these 100,000 Japanese Americans on the West Coast? They could be a threat. They need to be removed. That was a common mentality for people throughout government. In fact, one of the real bad guys of that was a guy that pops up with the Warren Commission named John McCloy, who advocated in the FDR administration and pushed for removing those people. He said the Constitution was no more than a piece of paper. But Roosevelt thought of that, no, it wasn't just a piece of paper. And she enacted a promise from FDR that you will not do this to these people. And FDR basically, due to pressure, went behind her back and went ahead and passed Executive Order 9066, where those 100,000 Japanese Americans were removed anyway. And I think her relationship with FDR was never the same. So why do I bring up all this? Because, well, you know what? In 1988, the country recognized and righted a wrong. President Reagan signed the Civil Liberties Act, officially apologizing to the survivors that were stuck in those internment camps during the war, that lost their property, that gave them $20,000 in reparations. What done was done, but sometimes in a democracy you need to right a wrong, and that was done. But here's the point to be made. Eleanor Roosevelt died in 1962. She never lived to see that day when that thing that she fought for would be realized, that there would be vindication for her efforts. And I see that with maybe, there's of course Eleanor, and I see that maybe with what researchers that have been involved in this thing for so long, all of us, you know, maybe we don't ever see the day where this whole thing is finally, we get some vindication, we get some justice for what happened in Dallas. Maybe not in our lifetimes, but maybe, you know, in some future time, or maybe people are not in, you know, feel more unencumbered by the stigma of conspiracy or those that might have agenda to cover things up. But it is important, you know. You know, as I make these comparisons between Dallas and what happened in Washington this past year, you know, I don't think our country can take another one of those events. You know, I think we're in a fragile place right now in America. You know, if something like, you know, our democracy could collapse. It's one of these things happens again. It makes it important that we bring to light what truth and justice is in these events. And that's pretty much what all I have to say tonight. I apologize if I gave you a little history lesson at the end. That's what I'm all about. But I appreciate the opportunity to talk about all these things tonight. If you've got any more questions, I know it's been a long night. I hope you enjoyed it. But that's basically, Dave, that's pretty much what I have to go forward. And I'm welcome any questions.
Well, absolutely, David. And it's kind of like basically how you were talking about Stone's movie and how you make the comparison between 1963 and 2021. The whole thing is, you know, art imitates life and history repeats itself.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, and these things can't, you know, with the whole Dallas affair, I mean, there are things that come to mind, like You know, a lot of people have talked about the 7 days in May. I encourage my students to go back and watch that movie, 7 days in May. Maybe it is, you know, life imitating art. Or, you know, when I talk about, you know, my political assassination class, which, you know, I don't think we should leave tonight without mentioning the fact that, you know, a small victory for those of us who look at these things, that Sirhan, you know, finally got parole. And, you know, hopefully the governor doesn't step in and prevent a 77-year-old man who a lot of us think, you know, was just another passage, might finally get a chance to go free. But in that case, I mean, a lot of folks discuss the movie Manchurian Candidate. Is that art? You know, did I get that backwards? Life imitating art, and it's easy to get that backwards, you know? So, yeah, I mean, history does and will repeat itself. I mean, that's an important thing for all of us to know.
Well, and it's very important, and I want to say thank you for being a professor, a teacher. And Casey was a teacher too on the topic of history, and in particular JFK assassination. You know, it's commendable for, you know, reaching out and teaching the kids of today, because unfortunately, I know from when I was in school compared to what the kids get taught now, and I have three kids, two that are still in school. And it just seems like, you know, teaching of our history and of what actually took place, it's not taught like it was back in my time, back in probably your time or Casey's time. So the only way that people are going to learn about, and especially students, and I'm really glad that you brought the students up to Kansas City when we had our spring conference, the only way that we're actually going to be able to get these kids to hear about this is, you know, something like this in this format, because it's not part of the curriculum in standard schools today. So, you know, want to commend you on that.
Yeah, and I think one of the things we face, you know, when I say face, you know, you still you pick up a history book, and you'll still see, you know, it'll talk about a little paragraph about, you know, what happened in Dallas, and mention, you know, a lone assassin, Lee Harvey Oswald, acting alone, blah, blah, blah. You're still getting that. Now, there are a lot of history teachers out there, you know, that, you know, like Casey, that took the time to really dig into this and really show or illuminate some another side of this story. And it is important. I would say students today they don't know a whole lot about this, but wow, boy, if you bring up, I mean, like I mentioned earlier, my class that I have this semester, I have, I think the most I've had, like 20 signed up for it. And that's a good number, because my class is an elective, which means they, you know, they can't really work, they're not working towards a degree other than just for elective hours. So they kind of want it based on an interest. And 20 is a good number, and they are just, man, They're really tuned into what I'm saying. They're young people can be very intrigued by this topic. They're not ready they may not know a whole lot, but they're not ready to just dismiss it as dead history either. When you present the facts of the case and the potential injustice that we keep talking about, that gets their attention. It will.
Absolutely.
So,
well, it looks like we've got a couple hands raised, and I've got a comment here in the comment section. Let me get this comment out real quick from Peter McKeever. It says, has anything emerged recently in the declassified documents linking Morales to the RFK assassination?
I have not seen anything of that nature. And I know that's – was that kind of mentioned with the I think some of the stuff that came out, or was that more with the, you know, a few years ago, some of that stuff came out, and there were some pictures associated with in the Ambassador Hotel. But I have not. Have you heard anything in that regard, Dave? I haven't.
I have not.
In RFK?
I haven't heard anything on it, but it's really a good question to bring up, and also something maybe to look at.
So the gentleman from Ireland has done so much work. His name's escaping me. I've had I think some people know out there. Wasn't there some film associated with the maybe Joe Anides that might have been somebody that thought might have been Joe Anides that might have been in the Ambassador Hotel, but that's all just vague stuff. I mean, that bears more research. But I mean, you know, but if you invert that question and say, okay, if the Central Intelligence Agency was involved in the assassination of RFK, who would they get to be involved in that? Who would be at the top of the list? Maybe it would be Morales. Now that's just pure speculation. Okay.
Yeah, I and the researcher you're talking about, Shane O'Sullivan, is I think that's one you're thinking of.
And I prefer that question, that fellow, Shane O'Sullivan, you know, who knows as much about the RFK story as anybody, you know, to look into that. Obviously, Lisa Peace, too, who spoke at our conference. Two great researchers on the whole RFK story, definitely.
All right, well, let's go ahead and move on. Don's got his hand up, and he made a really good comment in the chat log. Don, why don't you go ahead and hit your key point on what you wrote in the chat log, and if you've got a question or a comment for David, go ahead.
I'll be happy to. Thank you, David. Thank you, everybody. Thank you especially, David Denton. Appreciate your presentation. An interesting note, it was because of the conference that David put on in 2014 that I got involved in the JFK Assassination Conference, and I'm grateful for the things that has led to. And I just finished reading David's book. This is not a plug. It's just something I've chosen to do. I just read it about a couple weeks ago, and it's fascinating. If you haven't read it, highly recommend it. So, David, you brought up something that I found interesting when you were talking about Byrd and Oswald working at the Texas School Book Depository. And then the interesting connection that he also worked at the Riley Coffee Company, which was an extreme ultra right wing, you know, place that you just couldn't bring a communist to work there, or a person who was supposedly a communist working at the Riley Coffee Company in New Orleans. Another interesting connection, wouldn't you say?
I didn't get a chance to cover that, but man, I mean, the right-wing fanatics that were down there in New Orleans. I mean, you know, I mentioned Miltier, but you could take Guy Bannister. Okay, of course, who obviously probably had some connection to Oswald. And, I mean, he's connected with all the same fanatical Nazis and KKK. And there was a strong interconnectivity of those people throughout the country, and at what level they were, was their engagement with the JFK assassination? I don't know, but this thing just keeps coming up. I mentioned Clint Murchison Sr., who, you know, was certainly one of the most powerful people in the country and a Kennedy hater. Ed Tatro pointed out to me that Murchison sent contributions to George Lincoln Rockwell, the head Nazi. I mean, there's a direct connection with someone in the extremism, and you know, that's why it's a little bit scary when you start bringing out that same thing that happened in January, the fanatical extremism of some of these groups. Now they're not as powerful around the country, but there's still a threat. I think the difference between 2021 and 1963 is that some of those right-wing fanatics resided at the highest levels of power. You know, now maybe they're more fringe-type people today, but they're still a threat to do things. But and they keep popping up. You're right. Down in some of the most fanatical folks in the country. And let's point out another thing. Oswald's address book is filled with Nazis. I mean, that he was connected, whether he was connected, tracking, or engaged with, you can't ignore that. So that's a great point, Don. I appreciate it. I appreciate the good comments about my book. Again, the cheap plug there, segue, lulu.com. It's just a series of essays I've written over the last few years that about a lot of things you might find interested in. But thank you for the comments, Don. Appreciate it.
And I also appreciated, you know, your comment about Ferry. What an interesting character, and interesting to have him been at the JFK conference for a couple of years, and feelings about him and some of the things that he was saying. But I'm glad that you did the research and dug a little deeper, and perhaps brought to light some things that he at least had evidence of having been involved in.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible stories that he told, and he brought to light his connection with the Elliott Janeway. He was in the Johnson administration, and some of the confidence that Janeway told him before the assassination about that. And you can read that in the article. But the thing about what I did with Ferry, because, again, when you talk to folks, when you look at folks, who they are, where they came from, a lot of what you depend on is their accounts. And sometimes they are hearsay. I mean, in other words, did somebody giving you an account, but how much, can you get some other reinforcement and confirmation of it? And that, again, proves difficult. But with Ferry, what I think is important, and if you go to my website, JFK Historical Group, I mean, I had Ferry send me everything he had in terms of documentation, because he made a who he was, all his political connections, his military connections. And I'm telling you, he had everything. He had tons of documentation that he was what he said he was. Now, if you want to believe his story or not, that's another thing. There's a picture on my website of Gordon Ferry as a young soldier standing guard of the detail protection standing right next to JFK that he sent me. So I think he's who he was. And Ferry's a guy that, and by the way, he has no, they always ask the question, no, Gordon Ferry is not related to David Ferry. Okay. They're two different people, two disconnected people. But again, thank you for that, Don. Appreciate you jumping on tonight.
Glad to be
Okay. Any other questions?
Yeah, thanks again, Don, for those comments and questions. I'm going to get to Brooks LaPlante here in just a quick sec. I just want to let everybody know a little bit of trivia here. You talked about Guy Bannister, the actor that played him in the movie JFK, Ed Asner, who was actually a Kansas City boy originally. He just passed away. So another one of the guys that we had in the JFK movie that, we've lost along the way.
I saw that. Great guy.
Oh, yeah. And hell, he was Santa Claus, so, in the movie Elf. So it couldn't have been all that bad,
Fuck my foul!
Well, go ahead, Brooks. You've got your hand up.
It's very easy to do that. All right.
I think my mic is on.
Yeah, go ahead, Brooks. We can hear you.
Hi, Brooks. Good to talk to you.
Hey, guys. I was jotting down a bunch of stuff through the whole presentation, but this last, when David mentioned Eleanor Roosevelt and the Japanese internment, made me think, sometimes we get so hardened in our positions, and I think particularly with the media today, the way things are, you got to be careful which water cooler you decide to drink from every day.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
Yeah, I'll give you an example of that in a second. But I had an uncle who fought in the Pacific during World War II. He had four kids. One of his boys, after the war, he ended up settling in Southern California, and he worked in aerospace. He was a tool and die guy. One of his boys ended up meeting and marrying a Japanese girl, and his dad disowned him, and they never spoke again.
Yeah,
and to get to that point where your heart gets so hardened that you could do that to your own son. Now there's my wife's father fought in the Pacific, and he was a flamethrower. He was one of those guys that walked up to the cave and did the dirty deed. And he never talked about the war afterwards. it had tremendous psychological impact on. I get all that. But sadly, we can get hardened. My wife's got six siblings. The three sisters are all really extreme liberals. The three brothers are all hardcore conservatives. We still get together for Thanksgiving.
Right?
We get together for Thanksgiving and nobody throws food. You know, it doesn't get real ugly. But I've learned to kind of keep an open mind just for the sake of family harmony and that type of thing. But
you got a list. Yeah. I mean, and you talked about the Japanese thing a little bit. I mean, I can remember, that my dad's era too. And the whole thing, I can remember the, as a young boy where there was a lot of resistance by some folks from the World War II era about why are people going out and buying Japanese cars, that there was still that hardened, like you say. Yeah. And then a lot of it was understandable. It was bitter enemies. But, what impresses me about Roosevelt, because I've always been this way, is, you go out and you fight for the little guy. You go out and fight for the people who have no voice. Or the that's what the Constitution's all about. You know, that you defend folks that maybe everybody else hates, because that's what America's supposed to be, And
it's what he called the forgotten man.
Yeah, but democracy is so hard to maintain, because anybody can have, there's authoritarian regimes all over this world today. It's easy. Those are easy things to do, to take power, be muscles, put in a fascist dictatorship where you control all the thought and the ideas. The hard part is democracy, where you have to constantly have to engage the truth. You have to maintain some level of justice or this whole thing falls apart. And I think we all feel like that, we keep rolling back to the JFK thing. And for those of us that have been involved in this, that is the injustice of our lives. It is to me. I don't know about you guys, but it is to me. That is there are a lot of things in America that are not right. And we have issues. I talk about my class here, issues of race. And if you think they're not still there, then you're being Pollyanna. There are a lot of things that are wrong about America that we've done wrong, but we still have to fight to correct our history, to right the wrongs. And this is the one that sticks out in my mind. That's why I'm here. That's why you guys are probably here too, right?
Right. I want to jump back to January 6th real quick.
Yeah.
Okay. I've got several of William Pepper's books. On Martin Luther King.
Yeah, I've read some of them, not all of them.
One of the things that happened in Memphis is King came to Memphis, then he left, and shortly after he left, I think the next day, there was supposed to be a peaceful protest, a march, because the sanitation workers were on strike.
Yeah.
He goes into detail in the book that there were agents provocateur.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
That infiltrated that march. It turned violent. There was property damage and everything. And it was caused by these bad guys.
Exactly.
Okay.
That's what orchestrated getting King back to Memphis.
Exactly. Yeah, Pepper makes that point.
Right.
When Kennedy was killed, there was a standing joke that over half the people that were members of the Communist Party were actually FBI or government informants.
Oh, yeah.
So we know these groups are infiltrated, and Proud Boys and all the rest of these extreme groups, they've all been infiltrated.
The Proud Boys, the top guy in the Proud Boys wasn't he. He was an FBI informant, right?
Here's an interesting thing.
Yeah.
In October of last year in Michigan, there was a kidnapping plot to kidnap Governor Whitmer.
Exactly.
I think 13 people were arrested. Supposedly around 20 or more people were involved. It turns out that 12 of them are either FBI agents, on the FBI payroll, and you don't hear a lot about that. But there's certainly looks like the whole thing was kind of set up, and it.
Let me finish my point
because I'm going to make nexus from that to January 6th.
Yeah.
That is a false flag operation if in fact it's true. And there's a lot of speculation that some of the people that went into the Capitol, and just like it was with the sanitation march, it only takes half a dozen people to start doing crazy shit, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
That's a tinderbox. I mean, people were really on edge for a variety of reasons. And I don't care what side of the political spectrum you're on. But that thing was ready to blow, and it didn't take a lot to make it blow. And
so who made it blow? Right?
I'm not sure we'll know, but
that remains to be seen. Yeah, I see what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean,
I get what you're saying. What's going on with the FBI with these things? Why didn't they? You know, like with the whole thing with Whitmer, I honestly believe there's a lot of people that hate Whitmer. I mean, there's no doubt. I think there's some people that wanted to kill Whitmer. I mean, there's a lot of extreme feelings about a lot of the stuff, with this whole pandemic and stuff. And I know my niece lives up in Michigan, and there's some crazy people up there. I mean, and it's easy to understand. But why would the FBI monitoring these people and just kind of letting it play out? Were they pushing them along? You know, I mean, I get what you're saying. I mean, the FBI is a shadow operation. They have been in our past, and you can't take everything they've done in our past at face value. I get that. Anything else? Any other comments?
Well, just one last comment, and I'll give the mic over to somebody else. But I was looking at your list of comments that Millie made.
Yeah.
And you could almost argue, if you think that this January 6th thing was some type of a preordained operation, that those were preemptive remarks. Hey, get ready, because the coup, the insurrection is coming.
Yeah.
The other thing about a lot of these people that have been arrested, some of them are having a hard time getting legal representation, hard time getting to speak with their attorneys. People that should easily have had bail by now and be out are denied bail. They're not even getting court hearings.
Mm-hmm.
And the last thing, there are hundreds and hundreds of hours of video surveillance that are available and were taken in the Capitol. That's all under wraps. But it'll never see the light of day. We know the history of a lot of this stuff. Things just disappear.
Mm-hmm.
I just think there's a lot more to the January 6th story, no matter what side of the political spectrum you're on.
Yeah.
It stinks. Will we ever, it's kind of like the JFK thing. Will we ever really know the true story of January 6th?
Well, I find that, again, like whatever side you're on that too, like you say, but the one thing that even drew me into this whole stuff and looking at it is that quote that Millie had that said, you know, if you're going to, somebody's going to do this, they got to have the CIA, they got to have the military, they got to, I mean, it's just like, wow. I mean, you just define potentially may have what happened in Dallas. But anyway, be that as it may. Any other questions? I've had a bunch of fun tonight. I hope I imparted a few things that were of interest to anybody. Any other things, Dave, that you have?
Hey, David, Casey Quinlan, I just want to point out that you were quoting a lot of stuff from Mal Hyman. And,
yeah.
Here recently, I've been reading about four or five different books, and I decided to pick up Hyman's book and read the last five chapters today. And I swear to God, if you guys want some answers, he lays them out for you.
He's a great book.
Oh, God, I'm telling you what. And he lays them out with the idea that if you really want to see, in my opinion, based upon what I'm reading here, is that the crux of the people who are behind the murder of JFK are the elitists. They're the money people. I mean, you can't do anything without the goddamn money. I mean, if you're gonna murder the president of the United States, you're gonna cover the damn thing up for 58 years, and you're gonna take the media and do with Walter Cronkite all the way on down, Dan Rather, whoever. And you're going to pay these guys off to read other stuff. I mean, I used to yell and scream about Fox, the Fox News and the Fox Channel all the time. And right now I'm sitting there going, God, I'm not sure which is which anymore. But at the same time, Hyman puts this out and he says, you need to look at this stuff because, these are the people who, number one, who have been infiltrated by the FBI, infiltrated by the CIA, infiltrated by military intelligence, and they control the purse strings that probably sent out people in the military and the CIA and maybe even the Dallas police to go ahead and say, we're going to take care of JFK. Now, it sounds like a gigantic conspiracy. Well, I think it is, but only a handful of people know this. And so everybody just falls into place like regular military people.
Yeah, the book Casey's talking about, I believe it's called The Media and the JFK Assassination.
Yeah, bearing the lead, The Media and the JFK Assassination.
Bearing the lead, yeah, and it is Mal's a great guy. He's a professor. He knows how to do research. And he pretty much documents how the media treated the story from day one and all the way through. And you know, obviously that the indications of a cover up all the way through. It's a great book. Yeah. And by the way, Casey, how do you keep reading all these books, man? I can't keep up with you. Every time I turn around, you've read another book. And I it's hopeless. I can't keep up with you, man. I mean, I'm going to have to start listening to audiobooks in my sleep or something just to keep up with Casey Quinlan.
Well, I'll tell you what. You know, the bad part about it was when I was in high school, I hated to read. I just hated to read. And then and then somehow I picked up the Warren Report.
Good. What a place to start. How'd you start there?
There you go. You know, well, I'll be honest. I've never read. I haven't read the 28 volumes of the Warren Report.
Oh, God, I'm telling you.
I'll take my word of that it was a cover up, but I'll take the word for those who have. But
oh, God.
Yeah.
Anyway, I mean, David, thank you very much. It was a very good presentation tonight.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. I enjoyed it, and I hope all you guys did as well.
Well, yeah. Definitely. I want to thank David Denton for doing our spotlight series tonight, and just remember that the replay will be on YouTube. And if you get a chance to visit our YouTube channel, make sure you hit subscribe and hit the thumbs up on the videos that you watch. And also, keep checking out ProjectJFK.com. Also go to the JFK Historical Group website. And if you want, you can look on the affiliated tab on our website and it'll take you directly to their website. In case you don't want to have to try to search it on Google or whatever search platform that you use. But with that, I think we'll bring tonight's spotlight series featuring David Denton to a close. And again, keep an eye out on the events tab for our next journey meeting. It'll be the first part of September. And also our next spotlight series, there'll be an announcement for that. So with that, I'm David Knight with Project JFK CSI Dallas, and I want to thank you guys. We couldn't do it without you, and thank you for the support, and keep tuning in.
Thanks, Dave. Appreciate it.
Thank you, David. Thanks, everybody.